stupid, actually. So, in this country, we get very little reporting, really, about about how Corona is affecting the African continent. What is it, how is Corona actually reported on the African continent in America? You know, what is there anything reported about Corona on that continent, or is it zero?
Bloomberg has been publishing a map of the world which shows the level of vaccine distribution in different countries. And virtually the entire continent of Africa, more than 50 different nations, is just blank. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is our next guest, a Nobel Peace Prize recipient, former president of Liberia, and she says Africa may be left out until next year. Sirleaf recalls the Ebola outbreak, which hit her country, among others, in West Africa in 2015. Last year, she was asked to co-chair a review of the global response to this pandemic, and she says Africa is in danger of being left behind.
In Africa, we don't have the resources. It's as simple as that. Unless vaccine is seen as a free good on the basis that until everyone is safe, no one is safe. When it's seen in that context, then perhaps the wealthier nations of the world will come up with a formula that says, how can we share the vaccine with those countries that are under-resourced?
Vaccination at this speed on this scale is unprecedented, and even the United States has discovered logistical problems. It's very hard to get millions of doses to millions of people in a very short time. Are there even greater logistical challenges in parts of Africa?
We will face logistical challenges, no doubt, but I'd like to point out a case of Ebola, when Africa put up a platform to ensure that the medications and the responses to Ebola were made available through support of African countries, that this platform was used to ensure equitable distribution among those African countries in need. Of course, there were limited countries at that time because Ebola affected the three neighboring countries in West Africa. So maybe distribution was easier, so our population in those countries are much smaller than others. It would be more complicated if you have all of African countries.
We should recall that Ebola was an extreme stress on the societies of a number of countries. What were some of the ways that you learned to address public anxiety and to get genuine medical care to people?
Well, the first thing you need to get proper information, reliable information on the state of the disease so that proper communication is given to citizens so that they don't have to guess, they don't have to speculate as to the extent of the effect of the disease. And one has to have coordination. You can't have different entities involved in the health sector or involved in the financial sector. That's the only way you can win the confidence of citizens to ensure that even if you have the means to address it, that they take the medication or they adhere to the protocol, whether it's a mask or whether it's social distancing. And of course, in the case of Ebola, again, strong partnerships, because there too, the three affected countries did not have the resources to get the medication and to get the kind of support that was necessary. But they had good partners.
In the United States, as you probably know, Madam President, there are a lot of people who have expressed skepticism about masking and social distancing. They've declined to participate, and there's also a very widespread skepticism of vaccines. Does that all sound familiar to you?
Yes, it does. I mean, Liberia faced the same thing in the early days of Ebola. But we were able to overcome it through strong government action. And leaders have to be able to convey this, the severity of this disease to their lives and to their livelihoods in very clear terms, with very clear action and strong commitment, not only to formulate those measures, but to find a means to ensure that citizens understand them and are willing to comply for their own safety.
I'm realizing that part of the reason I was a little surprised by the pandemic when it came was that I remembered the experience of Ebola, that there was a terrible virus, but that it was contained in one part of the world. It did not go worldwide. Granting that a pandemic is always possible, were you surprised that this virus got out of control in a way that Ebola did not?
Yes, because of the failure to carry out the measures to address the virus. I must say, in the case of Ebola, I said initially, we faced the same problem, the problem of confidence, that people who thought maybe this was, you know, somebody trying to limit their ability to move about, their rights, you know, to freedom. Those are the kinds of concerns that citizens have, but it's up to leaders to address those fears and those concerns and to make sure that they overcome them.
Former President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
White supremacy is the sickness.
Los Angeles hospitals are being pushed to the brink. In the most populous county in the U.S., one in three people has been infected with COVID-19. Thousands have died. At the center of this surge is a community hospital in South Los Angeles that is serving the most vulnerable, hit hardest by this pandemic. NPR's Leila Fadel goes inside that hospital and reports the outsized impact is the result of healthcare inequities that have been around a long time.
Inside one of several triage tents in front of the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Hospital in Willowbrook, it's an unincorporated part of South LA near Compton and Watts. Heart rate monitors beep as COVID-19 patients are cared for while they wait for space inside. In the emergency department, patients lay in beds that line the halls. An older woman says in Spanish, "Please, no." She's confused, alone. Nurses calm her. Some patients wait for rooms. Others are treated right in the halls.
So we're living through a surge on a surge on a surge.
That's Dr. Ryan McGarry. He's watching entire families come in with severe symptoms of COVID-19.
And sometimes one leaves and one doesn't, you know, and that's brutal.
He compares this moment to battlefield medicine.
We're surrounded here by multiple tents and tubes and lines and, you know, effectively temporary structures to handle, you know, overflow on overflow.
This is a crisis, but this nonprofit safety net hospital has always served more than it was built to since the day the gleaming facility opened in 2015 to replace its predecessor, shut down in 2007 over deadly conditions.
We've been seeing a bit of a public health crisis in this community for the past 5 years.
That's Dr. Elaine Batchelor, the CEO in her office upstairs. The public health crisis? An epidemic of chronic illnesses, heart disease, pulmonary disease, kidney disease, diabetes, at much higher rates, as well as higher mortality rates. Here, she's working to get through this crisis, but also using it to highlight the need to bring the same quality of care to this underserved, largely Black and Latino community that, she says, more affluent communities get.
This is where the essential workers live. These are the people that are stocking the grocery stores, driving our buses, cleaning up after the rest of us. And they are continuing to be exposed to COVID on the job.
Add the dense housing where multi-generations of families live together, the poverty, the secondary health conditions, plus COVID, and it's an explosion of people getting sicker and dying more often.
Our small hospital now has more COVID patients than hospitals that are 3 to 4 times larger.
From this office, she wrote to the governor on Christmas Eve asking for help. The state sent 3 National Guard medical strike teams, travel nurses, respiratory therapists. She also made a plea for fundamental change.
We have a separate and unequal system of funding, and we see the results here.
COVID preyed on the inequities. The majority of patients that come into this hospital are on public health insurance. That pays a supplemental amount for inpatient care and makes hospitals sustainable. But that's only if a patient is so sick they have to be admitted. Meanwhile, public health insurance pays a fraction of what private insurance does for outpatient care. And that includes the emergency room that's triaging below her office.
They're in our emergency department a lot, because they don't have adequate access to care in the community, and we are paying for it.
They show up because there's a shortage of 1,200 doctors in South LA. Primary care doctors, specialists, don't set up where they can't make money.
You know, we've created a tiered financing system for healthcare with commercial at the top and Medicaid and uninsured at the bottom, and we need to change that. You know, because that's where many of our Black and brown communities are.
The most common procedures at her hospital are completely preventable diabetic amputations and wounds. And the irony is,
we're getting paid adequately to amputate someone's leg, but we're not getting paid adequately to to prevent that leg from being amputated.
So this small hospital leans heavily on philanthropy to bridge the gap and show what's possible. It's why it can pay nurses and doctors competitive salaries and bring in cutting-edge technology. But Batchelor says it's not sustainable without changes to the way healthcare is funded. On the fifth floor, the temporary ICU is inundated. After New Year's, the staff relocated it and converted half this floor to treat more patients. Every room is doubled up. All but four of the patients on this floor are on ventilators, many on dialysis, and most came in with secondary conditions that make COVID a much more severe disease. Bigger hospitals threw money at travel nurses. This community hospital turned to the state.
We were hit really hard, so tough is like an understatement. It's been horrible.
That's the ICU charge nurse, Maria Adichica. She grew up in Compton.
I know the community. So potentially, you know, this could be any of my family.
On top of supervising nursing staff, tending to patients, she finds herself translating for doctors because so many of the sick are Latino and Spanish speakers.
I have to sit there, or one of the nurses that speak English and Spanish with a straight face, and tell them, your family member is going to die.
Plastic tarps with zippers hang in the doorways to convert regular hospital rooms into makeshift negative pressure rooms to keep the airborne virus particles out of the hallways.
I feel like this time around, people are coming sicker and they unfortunately die quick.
As if on cue, Adichica has to run off. An alarm is sounding, a patient crashing, their organs failing.
Another crash cart?
I'm trying to get Bonnie to in here.
She hands supplies through the unzipped tarp to doctors and nurses frantically trying to resuscitate a patient in the room. They're in bunny suits, masks, and face shields. Then the patient in the neighboring bed goes into cardiac arrest. They call a code blue, a medical emergency.
Code blue, North Room 508.
Two people arrive with more protective gear, and more nurses and doctors suit up and go in to help get a pulse back.
Let's do a pulse check.
A has a pulse.
There is practice calm in the urgency. The staff work in tandem. And then Dr. Jason Prasso exits, walks away on the phone, and comes back.
One patient unfortunately did not make it. And I think, realistically speaking, the second patient, while we did get her back, is probably not going to make it either. And so I just want the families to have an opportunity to, like, you know, spend some time with them.
Behind him, Maria Adichica, with the help of other nurses, rolls the bed with the man's body out of the room and into another for privacy when the family arrives. Despite all they've learned, Prasso says the virus has proven difficult to manage.
There isn't a whole lot that I can offer besides supportive care as an ICU doctor and trying to prevent things from getting worse, and all too often that isn't enough. It hurts as a doctor to say that, but a lot of times, there's not a lot I can do for patients who have COVID. You know,
may I have your attention, please? Code blue, 5 North, room 501B.
Presso rushes off, another cardiac arrest. By the end of this shift, five people are dead, four Latino, one African American. A bad day, a familiar day. Layla Falden, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Calling a press conference late in the day, Kilpatrick talked about the great accomplishments that he said have been made under his administration and apologized for his shortcomings. He took a stab at Governor Granholm for holding a hearing on his removal and told the citizens of Detroit that his career is far from over.
F. Scott Fitzgerald once wrote that there are no second acts in American lives. The great writer that he was, F. Scott Fitzgerald, was not a Detroiter. Because we fall, but this city always gets up. And I want to tell you, Detroit, that you done set me up for a comeback.
Former President Donald Trump commuted the prison sentence of Detroit's ex-mayor Kwame Kilpatrick on his way out of office today. Kilpatrick had served about 7 years of a 28-year sentence for corruption. The announcement very, very early this morning was part of a flurry of clemency action. A White House statement noted that prominent members of the Detroit community had supported commuting the former mayor's sentence, and that while in prison, Kilpatrick had, quoting here, taught public speaking classes and led Bible study groups with his fellow inmates. Kwame Kilpatrick was convicted in 2013 of racketeering, conspiracy, fraud, extortion, and some tax crimes. With us today is Chastity Pratt. Right now, she's an education bureau chief at the Wall Street Journal, but she's been working in Detroit for a long time. And she was a reporter at the Detroit Free Press for a period of the Kwame Kilpatrick administration. Chastity Pratt, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi.
You know, it's been a while. A lot of people might know who Kwame is, but they might not remember the exact details of what landed him in jail. Can you run us through what led to his conviction?
Oh, yeah. So Kwame Kilpatrick, like you said, was this rising political star in the late 90s in Michigan. From 97 to 2001, he was in the state legislature, sort of following in his mom's footsteps because she was a congresswoman. Then 2001, he finds himself elected mayor of the city of Detroit at the age of 31. So from there, like, almost immediately, there was an air of controversy following him. Some people thought, oh, he was arrogant and young and brash and not deserving of his title and his office. Other people in Detroit, young voters, really turned out saying it's our turn, young people, to lead the city. And he had a lot of support. But, you know, 2002, very early in his, you know, mayorship, he's accused of having a wild party at the Manoogian mayor's mansion. It became the thing of legend and lore, and the city started investigating whether or not, you know, there was this wild party at the mansion. And what we see happening in, I believe it was it 2008? Yeah, 2008, there's this whistleblower lawsuit. The police officer, the investigator, Gary Brown, and another a police officer, Nelthrop, they essentially say Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick fired them or retaliated against them because they were investigating the party, the alleged Manoogian Mansion party. So they sue the city. And in that court case, Kwame Kilpatrick is later found to perjured himself. So therein begins like this long saga that turns into court case after court case after court case, dealing with corruption. Every seems like everyone in his circle is pulled in it, from his father to his best friends. And here, like you said, in October 2013, after spending more than a year in jail for some of these smaller convictions, 2013, the big conviction goes through. He's convicted of 24 counts of federal corruption charges and gets a 28-year sentence.
Yeah. Kwame Kilpatrick became a vessel through which people channeled so many emotions about Detroit and its leadership. This was true for Black Detroiters. This was true for White Detroiters. And people from outside the city just loved to opine about him. What is your take on why Kwame Kilpatrick was such a polarizing figure?
You know, I would say because Detroit is very racially polarized, you're always have had, and, you know, who knows for how long we'll continue to have people on different racial sides of just about every argument, right? So you have people who said, you know, he was corrupt, he needed to go down. And then you have people who say, look, yes, Kwame was wrong, but 28 years is too long, and that he was over sentenced because he was young Black man.
Right. I mean, his not to interrupt, but Kilpatrick's lawyers, just to explain, had asked for a 15-year sentence, and prosecutors went for almost double that. And you know, the people will remember there were folks asking, you know, would a white defendant accused of the same crime been given the same sentence? Do you think perceptions of his sentencing have changed over the past couple of years?
I don't know that perceptions have changed. You know, like a lot of political issues in our society, people look for confirmation of their own bias. You know, when Kwame Kilpatrick in 2019 writes to President Trump and says, "You're the greatest president ever, please let me out." And basically Trump ignored him. There were some people saying, well, that's the critics and opponents of Kwame Kilpatrick were saying, you know, that there he is again. There he goes again. He's arrogant. He's brash. He'll do anything that he has to benefit himself. And then you have some people saying, well, look, it was a very smart thing. He's shrewd and he should not be there for 28 years. Of course, he's going to write that letter. And I think that those, you know, people who are on either side of the Kwame Kilpatrick conundrum are probably not going to be swayed off of their opinions by what's happened with his commutation.
Have you heard much reaction today in Detroit?
You know, there have been several instances of people saying, Kwame's getting out, Kilpatrick's getting out. You know, it's funny because people who call him Kwame, some people do it in a way that is, you know, friendly, and some do it as a way to disrespect him. But, you know, several times there have been rumors that Kilpatrick was going to be released. And just around November, there was rumors that he was going to be released. And so in the last few hours since it's happened, I've been watching social media a lot. And again, the people who say he should be gone are like, yay, he's getting out. And the others are saying who think, you know, he was very corrupt and should still be there are saying shame, shame, shame. Of course, Trump would do something like this. I think a lot of the conversation right now is about why would Trump do this?
Yeah. Chastity, as somebody who was writing about the city in the years after Kwame Kilpatrick left office, and just as someone who's been living in the city all this time, do you think the conviction of this former mayor and others in his circle, do you think it changed anything about the political culture of the city?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you don't get a white suburban man to become mayor of the city of Detroit if not for Kwame Kilpatrick, right? You know, since I had been born, there had been a black mayor in the city of Detroit. And then all of this corruption stuff happens with Kwame Kilpatrick, and you have people saying, well, you know, the city is in turmoil, not only politically after the Kilpatrick scandal, but financially, because we were going through the biggest municipal bankruptcy in the history of America. So people were saying, look, well, maybe it's time for a well-connected white guy who knows rich people to come in and become, you know, mayor. So you don't have that without a Kwame Kilpatrick scandal happening and without the bankruptcy that happened afterward. And, you know, there were a lot of very good things that happened under Kwame Kilpatrick, which is why he was reelected in 2005, right on the heels of a couple smaller scandals, because there were some things that he was listening to regular folk, right? They said they wanted their parks cleaned up. He said, let's do it, you know, and just very close to the bone issues. He, you know, listened to people and they appreciated that. You know, we had the Super Bowl, we had the Final Four, but the other thing that happened was he signed the swaps deal, huge loan to refinance the city's debt. And at the time, the financial world celebrated him for it. But we know now that it was one of the biggest problems that led to the city's bankruptcy.
Speaking of Mayor Duggan, as you did a moment ago, I see he sent his congratulations to Kwame Kilpatrick today. What's that about?
I would totally be just guessing. But again, you have to realize Kwame Kilpatrick still has supporters in the city of Detroit. You know, all those people who signed that letter asking for his commutation. You know, you had Sherry Dagnogo, who was a rep and is on a school board. There were a lot of people who still support Kwame Kilpatrick. So it makes sense not to start a fight where you don't have one if you're, yeah, Duggan.
Chastity Pratt is a former reporter for the Detroit Free Press. You can read her today in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. She's their education bureau chief. Chastity, thank you so much for your time.
Anytime.
One final note. For those who are wondering, Kwame Kilpatrick is barred from holding office for 20 years after his conviction. That means that in the year 2033, the road would be clear if he wished to return to politics.
Where are you in Ohio?
Central Ohio.
Okay, is that near Mansfield, Columbus?
Columbus, Ohio is a diverse, vibrant, and growing city. Residents are trying to square that good stuff with two separate incidents in December where white police officers shot and killed black men. Here's Nick Evans of member station WOSU.
Saeed Jones moved to Columbus in 2019. The poet, writer, and former BuzzFeed editor quickly became one of the city's biggest boosters.
I think it's really fascinating that it like really reflects the entire country. We kind of have America living here. I think there's the energy of Columbus kind of stepping into, I don't know, like a new era in its identity.
But the past year has strained that relationship. Following George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis, protesters gathered here too. And some Columbus police responded brutally. They even pepper sprayed local Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, the Democrat now heading the Congressional Black Caucus. City officials promised reform, and they took some steps, like banning no-knock warrants. But then in December, a sheriff's deputy and a police officer shot and killed black men in separate incidents less than 3 weeks apart, rocking this city to its core. Saeed Jones is concerned about the way some police officers view black residents.
I think they look at them like problems to be solved, and the equation is brutal and seemingly lethal consistently.
Columbus Police Chief Tom Quinlan recognizes the problem and the mistrust.
I'll certainly say that it is a gap to be bridged. I mean, there is no doubt that we're not where we need to be.
That distrust has consequences. 2020 set a record for homicides here, and police repeatedly found themselves pleading for information from skeptical residents. Stephanie Hightower, who leads the Columbus Urban League, says that disconnect stems in part from officers' race and where they live.
There is going to be a disconnect when you don't live in this city and you don't know this community. You don't know the neighborhoods. You don't know who the players are. You don't have relationships. Now, do we have some officers who do build those relationships? Absolutely. Don't get me wrong.
Just under 10% of the Columbus police force is black, while black residents make up about 30% of the city's population. The police department doesn't track officers' residency, but did provide a breakdown by zip code. At least 40% of officers live outside city limits. Rayshon Ray studies police community relations at the Brookings Institute and says those figures are pretty typical across the country.
The key pattern is this. White officers are less likely to live in a city where they work. Black officers are more likely to. And I think a big wave that's starting to happen, and Columbus should consider this, is whether or not they want to implement a residency requirement.
Ray argues any requirement should be paired with incentives, like down payment assistance for homes. He also suggests police departments pay insurance premiums out of their budget to cover any civil settlements from police violence.
Not only will it be a level of accountability for the department, but also it will give leverage to police chiefs and mayors that talk about how they cannot get rid of bad officers.
Columbus Police Chief Tom Quinlan acknowledges the importance of embedding officers in the community. But he points out the city can't impose a residency requirement because the state Supreme Court has ruled against that.
We do want to find ways to incentivize it through residency credits, or I've looked at maybe possibly if we can get enough police cars have take-home cars if you live in the city.
Meanwhile, city leaders are flirting with more fundamental reforms.
And this question, you know, we want you to be bold. We want you to be forward-thinking. What is your vision for alternative crisis response?
During a recent town hall, Gail Saunders, who leads a local research firm, moderated an interactive survey on who should respond to service calls if not the police. Responses showed up like sticky notes cascading down the screen.
Oh, here we go. Wonderful. These are powerful, powerful. Children won't be afraid of police. Black people won't be needlessly murdered. Provide a service everyone feels comfortable and safe calling.
Columbus City Council will look to those ideas as it starts work on its budget next month. The council president says his top priority is finding a new way to respond when residents call 911, a response that may not immediately involve police. For NPR News, I'm Nick Evans in Columbus.
I want to be a cop. Can you keep your lips sealed? I think with leadership skills can turn low-level offenders into crisp bills. You know, I've always wanted to be a cop. With a uniform fit, we're calm in the seams. Peeing in niggas, call the greens, and they discuss the politics of dreams. This is why I've always wanted to be a cop. So I can criminalize the gate in your stroll, the shade in your mold, and take a toll. A displaced dark face as safe as an ace in a hole for a cop. As good as I, a book of guy for drinking crooked eye. Don't resist a pit and pie, you think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
On January 6th, thousands of rioters pushed past police barriers, defied police orders to retreat, and illegally broke into the U.S. Capitol building. Police officers were injured trying to control the crowd. One was killed. Now we are learning that some of the rioters were sworn officers themselves. I'm joined now by Kimberly Kindy. She's an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Hey there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So your story on this says at least 13 off-duty law enforcement officers are suspected of having taken part in some way in the riot. Even more than that, were at the rally before. What do we know about these 13?
We know that there are at least that many who are under investigation for going on to the Capitol grounds. But those numbers, as police and FBI continue to look at videos and photos, those numbers could, you know, potentially rise.
Yeah.
Just two officers who've been arrested by the FBI at this point. Those two officers, they posed inside the Capitol and sent a photo to one of their colleagues. And what was really interesting is that this person turned them in. And I was, as I was speaking to police chiefs and others, this is how some of these officers have been outed. Some of them have posted on social media, but in other cases, they've sent it to colleagues, and colleagues have gone to their police chiefs or their unions and said, this is crosses the line. I can't support this.
What type of consequences might they face? What do we know about how their home police departments are responding?
Well, the home police departments are putting them on leave if they have any evidence that they were involved with going into the Capitol. And those police chiefs are turning them into the FBI for investigation. On the union front, and I've been covering police issues for a very long time, union officials generally stand up for the officers and do what they can to defend them. That is not what I encountered when I talked to union officials this time around. They said, if you went into the Capitol, if you pushed past Capitol Police, you're on your own. Literally, the national president of the Fraternal Order of Police said, literally, you're on your own.
And what explains that? Because we hear so much in reporting about police misconduct, about the code of silence, the thin blue line, police officers who feel a real sense of loyalty to other police. Why would this be playing out differently, do you think?
Because this is such a violation of their sworn duty. They swear to uphold the Constitution. The other thing is just the fact that they not only broke the law, but they endangered Capitol Police officers, fellow police officers, pushed past them, violated their orders. They see this as such a breach to do this to other officers, and with deadly results.
You know, the big picture here, this comes, of course, after a year of intense scrutiny of police and of police violence. How worried are police leaders who you interviewed about the credibility of their entire profession?
They're very worried. They know their credibility is really on the line right now. They're struggling with what to do in the future about having people who are affiliated with and sympathizing with domestic terrorists. The history is incredible. I first started covering this after Ferguson, after, you know, Michael Brown was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri. And the reckoning that keeps happening is just head-spinning for me. That was a head-spinning moment. George Floyd was a head-spinning moment. And now this, just the visual of everybody being able to see not only what happened at the Capitol, but also seeing all these videos that go viral where they're seeing firsthand why communities of color have been complaining for so long. And they are having to take a really good hard look at what they're going to do to repair their relationships in those communities where one of the officers that they know that patrol their streets, that they built relationships with, they're the ones who are in the Capitol. And, you know, they say they feel betrayed.
That is Kimberly Kindy of The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
What started it? What made all this come?
Yeah. A black teenager was on the elevator, carrying a big box, and trying to carry the box, he stepped back and bumped up against a white woman. End of story. Riot is on. People formed at the, you know, he was arrested. People formed at the jail. A few black people showed up. Somebody, You know, everybody had guns, including black people back in those days in Oklahoma. Somebody fired a shot, and that was it. Stampede was on. Call out the National Guard, which is all white, and they added to it.
Inauguration Day is now 2 days away, and officials around the country are pulling out all the security stops. Just the same, worries kept Washington very much on edge today. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
For a moment, the drill became reality. This morning, soldiers and law enforcement practicing inauguration security suddenly sheltered for fear of attack. It turned out the threat was this nearby fire, which was quickly extinguished. But it shows the tension in Washington, D.C. ahead of Wednesday's inauguration. Thousands of National Guard soldiers continue to arrive. More than 25,000 will secure the city and surround the Capitol with rifles and bulletproof vests behind 7-foot-high fences. Downtown D.C. is on lockdown, a normally festive inauguration week replaced with barricades and security checks. The Washington Monument closed behind rings of security.
We're here to protect the citizens of the United States just as much as we are the seat of our government. So no one should fear us unless they have ill will in their heart.
Every guardsman takes an oath, and it's to defend the Constitution from enemies foreign and domestic. And as we've seen, sometimes the enemies are a little closer to home.
For the military, the fear is very close to home. The Associated Press found more than 20 Capitol Hill insurrectionists were current or former members of the U.S. military or of law enforcement. The FBI and National Guard are now vetting the guardsmen securing D.C. for ties to extremists. And the Guard is providing new training for how to spot anything, quote, not appropriate. Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy spoke to the AP.
January 6th, there were representatives from all of the services who were at the rally when it started on the Ellipse and then migrated towards the Capitol. So the question is that all of them? Are there others? We're continually going through the process and taking second, third looks at every one of the individuals assigned to this operation.
But a senior defense official tells PBS NewsHour the military remains concerned because Guard leaders don't know their soldiers well. And while the FBI will check guardsmen's names in law enforcement databases, neither the FBI nor the military have the time to check all soldiers' social media. Outside of D.C. and state capitals, the threat remains high. National Guardsmen secured Pennsylvania's seat of government and guarded the base of the state capitol in Atlanta. That deterred most of yesterday's planned armed protests, except in Salt Lake City, where a small group did bring their guns to town. And another small armed group showed up in Lansing, Michigan, despite a weekend show of force.
You hope for the best, you prepare for the worst, and clearly we're prepared.
Meanwhile, newly released video from New Yorker magazine journalist Luke Mogelson shows how unprepared the Capitol was for the January 6th siege. Rioters told police they were following President Trump.
If we're outnumbered, there's a million of us out there, and we are listening to Trump. You're the boss.
We can't be disrespectful.
Don't disrespect.
They can steal an election if we can't sit in their chair.
No!
Inside the Senate chamber, insurrectionists argued with each other, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Larry Brock used a military term for information operations.
It's an I.O. war. We can't lose the I.O. war.
We're better than that.
Hey, man.
But others took the space less seriously and cited senators who questioned the election.
Cruz would want us to do this, so
yeah, absolutely.
I think we're good.
I just want to let you guys know, this is like the sacredest place.
A lone police officer, severely outnumbered, eventually got them to leave, but made no arrests, despite the obvious, ominous threat.
It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming.
All right, come on.
Overwhelmed 2 weeks ago when the military presence was non-existent, the city, military, and federal government now hope an unprecedented show of force keeps the Capitol secure.
And Nick joins me now. So, Nick, you've been talking to so many people today. Bottom line, how concerned is the military?
Yeah, Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller released a statement saying there was no specific threat, but as we reported, the military is very concerned, according to the senior officials I'm talking to, in part because, again, they're not checking these soldiers' social media, and because commanders don't really know these guardsmen that well. They just don't spend that much time with them. So to try and mitigate that, there has been additional training institute for the guards as they arrive into D.C. to try and train everyone to look out for insider threats. But Judy, we are talking about this as or even after Guard have arrived in D.C. The independent analysts I talked to say it is simply too late in a comprehensive way to check whether there's any insider threats. In an ideal world, this would have done been done a long time ago in a much more comprehensive way.
And Nick, those independent experts, analysts you've been talking to, how good a job do they say the military has done searching for extremists in their ranks?
Yeah, so what the military says, it tries its best and it maintains an awareness of these threats, including right-wing extremists, and that on the active duty side, commanders spend a lot of time with their soldiers, and so they can keep an eye on them. But the independent analysts point out that the military is not a domestic intelligence agency. There have been lots of problems in the past, and frankly, there were veterans and people connected to the military who took part in the siege. And so earlier today, I talked to Heidi Beirich. She is the co-founder and chief strategy officer of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. She said the military is not doing well enough and that service members are targets.
Well, extremist groups are very keen on recruiting active duty soldiers and veterans into their ranks. They value the skills and the abilities that these people have learned while in the military. That goes for white supremacist groups, groups that perhaps want to engage in something like a race war. They want those skills in their ranks. And in the militia movement, the American militia movement, folks with a military background are probably the most prized members of the groups. You also have individuals who are involved in those groups before they join the military being encouraged by the extremist groups to get those skills.
So given those attempts, do you believe the military has taken the idea or the threat of extremists in its ranks seriously in the past?
Unfortunately, I don't. You know, in the military, there have been fits and starts in dealing with the issue of hate groups in particular, but the regulations always seem to come after the threat has shown itself. And one of the big issues we've had in recent years is that the military regulations are not up to the level where they need to be in a world in which people are radicalized online en masse, including troops, and in which extremist groups are recruiting from them. And, you know, folks in the military themselves know about this. The Military Times has done a series of polls that show between one third and one half of troops in the last 4 years have seen white nationalism in the ranks. So the military is not doing enough to root this problem out right now.
Beirich says that the military does a better job at kicking out gang members, Judy, than kicking out white supremacists.
So, Nick, what is it believed that the military could do to address these concerns?
Yeah, the answer to that is really fundamental, Judy, and it is the key question. And the experts say that it starts at the beginning. It needs to start with how the military recruits. But it also goes all the way to how the military defines the threat itself. So here again is Heidi Beirich.
There's quite a few things that could be done here. They need to tighten screening of recruits when they're coming into the military. Right now, the military doesn't even have a comprehensive tattoo database, which could show them when someone comes in from their tattoos that they've been involved in extremist groups. They need to monitor social media. They need to tighten the regulations to include a ban on involvement in paramilitary militia groups. That doesn't exist right now. And members of the different parts of the armed forces who worked in the investigative divisions didn't even among themselves agree on what they should be looking for. So there are a whole host of things that need to happen to fix this problem.
Beirich says the military can take this more seriously, Judy, and the Biden administration can actually take steps to make this a priority as well.
It's called respect for our country. Many people have died. Many, many people. Many people are so horribly injured. I was at Walter Reed Hospital recently, and I saw so many great young people, and they're missing legs, and they're missing arms, and they've been so badly injured. And they were fighting for our country. They were fighting for our flag. They were fighting for our national anthem. And for people to disrespect that by kneeling during the playing of our national anthem, I think is disgraceful.
We're still learning new information about the people involved in the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. One trend that has alarmed military leaders is the number of veterans who appear to have taken part in the insurrection. By NPR's count, nearly 20% of people charged in connection with the attack and rioting are veterans. NPR investigative correspondent Tom Dreisbach is here to talk about what we found. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Ari.
So begin by giving us an overview of your findings.
Well, we took a look at everyone we could find who's facing criminal charges in connection with the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. The charges run everything from curfew violations to unlawful entry of the Capitol grounds, theft of government property, weapons charges, assault, among others. And anecdotally, we had heard reports about a number of military veterans among the people who were involved in some way. We knew, for example, about Ashley Babbitt, who was killed by police while climbing over a barricaded door inside the Capitol building. She was an Air Force veteran. You might have also seen photos of a guy inside the Capitol wearing a military-style helmet, tactical vest, and carrying flex cuffs. Well, federal prosecutors said his name is Larry Brock, and he's an Air Force veteran. And so what we wanted to know is exactly how big is this group?
And as we said, the number is close to 20%, almost one in five people. Put that into context for us. How does that compare, for example, to the overall percentage of veterans in the U.S.?
Yeah, about 7% of all adults in the U.S. are military veterans, according to the Census Bureau. So that proportion of vets among people facing charges is quite a bit higher. But there are close to 20 million veterans in the country overall. It's a large, very diverse group of people, especially the younger generation. And the vast majority, we should say, do not get involved in extremism. But, of course, this is still a problem.
Is there any way of quantifying how big a problem this is in the armed forces and among veterans?
Yeah, I mean, our colleague Tom Bowman reported that last year the FBI had notified the Defense Department of 68 investigations of current or former service members in connection with possible domestic extremism. There's also a survey by the Military Times last year that found about a third of active duty troops said they had personally witnessed white nationalist activity in the military, things like drawing swastikas or getting white supremacist tattoos. Now, I talked to Mark Pitkavage of the Anti-Defamation League about this, and he said, you know, so far the military's efforts to combat extremism in its ranks have largely been haphazard.
So an extremist discovered in one unit on one base over here, there may be prompt action taken. The person may be very quickly administratively processed out. A very similar extremist in another unit on another base somewhere else, maybe nothing is done.
Well, Pitkavage says there really needs to be systemic training throughout all of the services so everyone knows how to identify a problem and what to do once they spot it. And the Biden team has said that rooting out extremism is now a top priority for their administration.
Tom, this problem has newly become apparent, but is it a new problem?
No. I mean, we've known that some extremism groups, extremist groups like the Oath Keepers, for example, they have specifically targeted veterans for recruitment over the years. And the concern is that military veterans often do have specialized training, which can make attacks more deadly. You know, some experts point to Timothy McVeigh, who killed 168 people in the Oklahoma City bombing years ago. He was an Army veteran. And so the stakes can be high, but, you know, we should say among vets, you'll also find really strong resistance to extremism, too. The police officer, Brian Sicknick, who was killed that day at the Capitol defending it from the mob, he was also a veteran, and he served in the Air National Guard.
NPR investigative correspondent Tom Dreisbach. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ari. White girl, I got that. White girl, white girl,
white girl, white girl, white girl. A Stratford woman was arrested in Washington, D.C. for attempting to impersonate a law enforcement officer. It all started when 63-year-old Linda McGovern was stopped at a security checkpoint set up for the presidential inauguration. News 8 Shana Ferreira brings us more tonight from Stratford.
Linda McGovern's husband says this whole situation was a misunderstanding. This as his wife sits in a D.C. prison cell facing multiple charges. Police say she impersonated a police officer, and she also claimed that she was part of the incoming president's cabinet. A debacle in our nation's capital leading to the arrest of a Connecticut woman, 63-year-old Linda McGovern, arrested Saturday for attempting to impersonate an officer at an inauguration security checkpoint. Police say McGovern reportedly approached the perimeter presenting what was identified as a military challenge coin. She stated she was a law enforcement officer and part of the presidential cabinet. Police questioned her and told her to put her car in park. She complied, but when asked for her driver's license, she drove off. She was then stopped and arrested. This comes as thousands of law enforcement and National Guard members have descended on Washington for President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. Back home, neighbor Marianne Lichtenberger says she can't believe what she's learned.
She doesn't have a mean bone in her body. She is very passionate for the Democratic Party, and especially, actually, I was surprised to hear that she went down there.
The neighbor tells us McGovern is an educated and brilliant woman and adds that she knows her to be harmless.
I just think she wanted to be part of the Democratic takeover. She's also brilliant. So I wish I had her crackerjack memory. I wish I had she researches everything.
And when asked if she believes her neighbor was a threat at all to national security.
No, not that kind of a person. She's no dummy.
Now, News 8 has learned that the suspect, Linda McGovern, has not had any prior arrests here in Stratford, but police say they have responded to her home for separate welfare check incidents. Of course, we'll stay on top of this story and bring you the very latest. In Stratford, Shayna Ferreira, News 8.
White girl, I got you. White girl, white girl, white girl, white girl. White girl. White girl.
Now to new developments in the Capitol chaos. Right now, the St. Louis area woman seen holding the House Speaker's sign is back out on the streets tonight. Emily Hernandez from Sullivan faces 5 federal charges for her part in the Capitol Hill riots 2 weeks ago. News 4's Russell Kinsall is on that story for us tonight. And Russell, you saw Hernandez as she turned herself into the FBI in downtown St. Louis.
Yeah, that's right, Corey. And just a couple of minutes ago, Emily Hernandez and her attorney walked out after being processed by the FBI. Her attorney pointed out that she understands that this is a very situation, that serious situation that she faces, but he made the point that she was not charged with any violent crimes. He also said that she was allowed to go after being processed here. She was allowed to leave and go home because earlier in the day, a judge ordered her released on her own recognizance. Hernandez and her attorney arrived shortly before 5 p.m. at the FBI office for her to be processed. Earlier in the afternoon, she made her first appearance before a judge in a virtual court hearing. She told the judge that she understood the charges against her and that she currently lives with her parents. In court documents, prosecutors showed photos and screenshots of video taken of Hernandez inside the Capitol and outside on the steps. In the photos, she's holding a sign that has Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi's name on it. Her attorney told me that she understands there are consequences for her actions and wants to put this behind her as soon as she can.
She's the girl next door, and it's an unfortunate situation. It's a situation that she did not want to put herself in.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
She's the girl next door, and it's an unfortunate situation. It's a situation that she did not want to put herself in. But like I said, she's willing to move beyond it, do the things that she needs to do to make it right, and get on with the rest of her life.
So take a look at these photos a News 4 viewer sent us of another person from the St. Louis area suspected of taking part in that siege on the Capitol. The man in the photos is seen wearing a jacket with the name of a St. Louis company called Stone Fabricators Tile. I spoke with the owner of the company who said he was horrified to see his company name on a jacket worn by someone who was there that day. And he said he believes the man in the photo is an employee who was fired last summer. He said the photos were also sent to him by a group trying to identify people involved in the riot.
You know, we they asked for information, which, you know, we declined to give out, and then we were, you know, but we did get with the FBI and send the information on to the FBI.
The owner of the company also told me he did not want to give the name of that employee because that person has not been charged with any crime. As far as Emily Hernandez go, her next court appearance is scheduled to be in Washington, D.C. Her attorney says it remains to be seen whether or not he could work out to have that done virtually so she doesn't have to travel all the way there and can stay here in the St. Louis area. But that is yet to be worked out. No date set for that court appearance. Live downtown, Russell Kinsall, News 4.
The Watcher.
Civil liberties advocates are warning the insurrection at the Capitol could lead to new police and surveillance powers. They say if history is a guide, those tools could be used against black and brown people in the justice system, not just the white supremacists who stormed Congress. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
Albert Fox Conn watched in horror this month as rioters beat and shoved their way into the U.S. Capitol. The civil rights lawyer says the images made him angry.
You know, in that moment, I myself felt that same anger that I want to catch these guys after seeing what they did to our Capitol. And that anger, that frustration, that desire for justice, that can lead us to very dangerous places.
Conn runs a group that fights what he calls invasive surveillance technologies, things like facial recognition and the use of cell phone location data. Conn worries all of those things are on the table as lawmakers confront how close they came to danger, embraced even by members of Congress who have been open to the idea of reducing police power, such as incoming Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York, who now proposed expanding the federal no-fly list to add Capitol rioters.
These insurrectionists, many of whom are known to be at large, should not be able to hop on a flight.
The head of the FBI's Washington field office, Stephen D'Antuono, would not rule it out at a news conference last week.
As for the no-fly list, we look at all tools and techniques that we possibly can use within the FBI, and that is something that we are actively looking at.
Critics say the no-fly list discriminates against Muslims and other minorities. They call the list bloated and mostly ineffective, since it contains information that can be wrong or out of date. The deadly assault on the Capitol is also reviving the idea of creating new federal crimes. Greg Nogheim works at the Center for Democracy and Technology.
Some people are calling for a new law that would create a domestic crime of terrorism.
That idea has won support from former national security prosecutors and a trade group for FBI agents. President-elect Joe Biden has expressed openness to a new domestic terror law, too. But Nogheim says, not so fast.
And the reason there is not such a crime is because there's concern, and it's legitimate, that such a statute would be used to squelch legitimate free expression.
Nogheim points out federal prosecutors are already considering the charge of sedition against some culprits. He says sedition carries a 20-year prison sentence.
It would be a shame if the response to poor policing was to give the police more authority that would infringe on civil liberties.
Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar agrees. She tweeted, quote, "We cannot simply expand the tools that have oppressed black and brown people. The answer is not a broader security structure or a deeper police state. We have to stay rooted in a love of justice and of human rights and of civil liberties as we seek accountability." The FBI wouldn't confirm whether it is using facial recognition tools to help identify the mob that stormed the Capitol. But civil rights lawyers have a hunch they are. Faulty facial recognition has led to wrongful arrests of black men. Catherine Crump is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley.
And until those racial disparities are fixed, this is not a technology that should be deployed on a widespread basis.
Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
White riots at the center of empire. With the rise of the Trump presidency, few events were more remarkable than the 2017 white nationalist rallies in Charlottesville, Virginia. Here we saw the naked face of white hatred, fear, and anxiety, seemingly inspired by a presidency brought into being in part by the false claim that the nation's first black president wasn't born in the U.S. Who could guess that less than 4 years later, another white riot would erupt, this time at the nation's capital, the halls of Congress, where yet another false claim, that of a stolen election, would provide the spark to a flame of insurrection. These two furious events form bookends of time, a four-year period of a presidential term marking the malice unleashed by Trump. They also provide insight into to white entitlement, the deep-seated belief that public space is white space. They attacked the Capitol in the light of day, shattering windows and crashing through doors. They beat cops like drums, whipped them with batons, sticks, and flagpoles, and dragged them down steps. And they did so on camera. One cop was later interviewed and said he was being assaulted at the Capitol by protesters who said they liked and supported police, especially during summer conflicts with groups like Black Lives Matter. The cop remarked that many of the Capitol protesters suffered from what he called cognitive dissonance. But guess what? Among those attacking Congress were active duty and retired cops from across America. Amazing. Trump played the role of America's Caligula, the Roman emperor, vain, petty, cruel, mean, who strived to humiliate Roman senators, who hated all of those who would not worship him, ruled for 4 years until his armed guards dispatched him. King Trump waged war against Congress and earned himself his second impeachment for incitement to insurrection. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol has prompted FBI and local law enforcement agencies to try to identify those who participated in the assault. Some of the white supremacists, conspiracy theorists, and neo-Nazis so far identified seem to be among the very people we'd rely on to protect the public: police officers, firefighters, some current and former military members. Now, security officials must also try to figure out how to root out extremism within their ranks. We're joined now by Chief Art Acevedo, Chief of Police at the Houston Police Department. Chief, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Simon. Thank you for having me.
As I don't have to tell you, one of your officers has been detained, Tam Pham, 18-year veteran of the force. He has resigned. He denies committing any acts of violence. But what's your reaction?
Well, I was incredulous. The thought that one of our police officers, or any police officer for that matter, whether or not they participated in violence, whether or not they participated in the destruction of property, to think that they could be part of a mob, in a mob that many people were set on sedition or even maybe murder. It's just, it's flabbergasting. I think it's angered us, but it is what it is. And now we have to try to continue our investigation to identify any other officers across the country that may have been there and everyone else, because they all need to be held accountable, and they need to be held accountable to the full extent of the law.
Well, let me understand how you see that law. Chief, for example, does a police officer, a Houston police officer, have a right to attend a rally?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, police officers have the same First Amendment rights as others. And so any officer that might have gone to former President Trump's rally, that's within their rights. But any officer that went beyond that in terms of going to that Capitol, being part of the mob, and entering that Capitol and committing any other crime, and I would add that unlike some of the insurrectionists that we saw, police officers took an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States, to abide by the rule of law. They not only violate laws, they also violated their solemn oath. And I think for that, there should be some additional consequences.
What are you in the department doing to see if Officer Pham is the only person?
In this instance, as it relates to the Capitol attack, our federal partners and our own officers and investigators that work jointly with the Joint Terrorism Task Forces across the country, they're utilizing technology to try to do three things: identify those who participated in the attack. Two, we try to use technology to identify and preclude people from those mindsets that are not consistent with what we require our police officers and hearts. We want people with good hearts and good minds to keep them from being police officers and also to try to identify those that might have already made it onto our lands.
I noticed a phrase when you said you have to be alert for officers have to have the right mindset. The implication is that there are just certain thoughts Houston police officers can't hold, whether or not they ever act on them.
We are a public service agency,
mm-hmm.
and we're here for the greater good of the American people. If I find out that someone thinks that African-Americans are subhuman, are not worthy of the air that we breathe, mm-hmm. whether or not they've acted on that, that is not the mindset that we want as a police officer, right? Because policing is for people that understand that every human being that we come in contact with mm-hmm. has the same equal value.
It sounds like there are certain phrases that would pique your interest and would set off questions, if not a formal investigation.
Yeah, but I think that's the same for any person. Yeah. When we're looking at social media, and this is kind of the problem that we have in our country in terms of domestic terrorism, right? Looking back in the last 10, 15 years, there are a lot of extremists. They don't all speak Arabic. Many of them are born and raised here. They happen to be Caucasian. They happen to be American. They happen to be homegrown. And they happen to be the number one threat, according to the FBI's threat assessments here in the last couple of years.
Chief Art Acevedo of the Houston Police, thanks very much.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
And these days there is, including in the mainstream media, a lot of self-righteous hand-wringing and denunciation concerning what is supposedly wrong with sports. For example, there's been a lot in the news lately about Barry Bonds, who just surpassed Babe Ruth for a number of home runs in a career. And he's closing in on Hank Aaron, who holds the record for a number of home runs in baseball. And it's interesting that when Hank Aaron finally broke the decades-held long record of Babe Ruth for total number of home runs, he got many death threats and other racist attacks simply because he was going to break the record of a hallowed white man. And this was in, you know, recent modern times, post-civil rights America, quote unquote.
As we've reported, one of America's greatest athletes, Henry Aaron, died today at the age of 86. I was privileged to know him a little. A few years ago, he and his wife, Billy, accepted my invitation to a press dinner here in Washington, where they were mobbed by admirers. And he received the longest standing ovation I think I've ever heard. He couldn't have been more gracious. It was typical of this man who, as Jeffrey Brown reports, endured blatant racism through much of his life.
And another standing ovation, number five.
Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, April 8, 1974. Henry Hank Aaron steps into the batter's box, one home run away from passing Babe Ruth for the all-time record.
Hit more to right and right center than the left. There's a long drive. Balls hit deep, deep. It is gone.
The moment, a capstone to a career that had already cemented Hank Aaron as one of baseball's best ever.
I felt great. I felt like I had the world was lifted off of my shoulders.
A great moment in all of sports history, but also one tinged with the bitterness of American history, as racism chased Aaron as he chased the record that would hold up for 33 years.
I got threatening letters about kidnapping and things like this, vicious, the racist letters. I had to slip out of the back of the ballpark with escorts and things like this. It was terrible, terrible. It was bad times for me.
His perseverance and grace throughout would gain him widespread admiration, and he became a trailblazer and inspiration for black athletes who followed. Aaron was born in Jim Crow-era Mobile, Alabama, during the Great Depression. He played his early baseball in the segregated Negro Leagues, and at 20 years old joined the Milwaukee Braves. He followed the team to Atlanta, and in 21 years with the franchise, Hammer and Hank became one of the game's most fearsome hitters. In all, Aaron slugged 755 home runs and amassed 3,000 hits. He was an all-star for 21 straight seasons and won an MVP award and a World Series title. In 1982, he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Today, tributes to Aaron poured in. Former President Barack Obama called him one of the strongest people I've ever met. We reached Dave Roberts, manager of the world champion Los Angeles Dodgers, by phone. He had this to say.
For me, even more so as a man of color, just to kind of think about how he handled the adversities and the personal hate towards him as he approached that home run record. And he always handled it with grace, dignity. And there was never any resentfulness when he was talking to current players or peers of his.
Hank Aaron died today at 86 years old.
And joining me now is Howard Bryant. He's a sports writer and author of The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. Thanks for joining us again. Let's start with the player first. I mean, we always talk about the home runs, but he was one of the all-time greats in every way, right?
No question. Let me just give you one example of how good Henry Aaron is or was as a player. When he came into the big leagues in 1954, his goal, his mission as a young player was to break Stan Musial's all-time National League hits record of 3,630. By the time his career started to move forward, he began realizing that the team, the Atlanta Braves or the Milwaukee Braves at the time, needed more offense. And so he decided to hit more home runs. And so one day I said to him, were you so good that you were able to choose which all-time record you wanted to break? And he sort of laughed about it, but it really is true that he had so much ability as a hitter that he started his career trying to break one all-time unreachable record and then ended up breaking another one.
It is, though, impossible to talk about the achievement without looking at all the evil that he went through. I was reading about a 20th anniversary after he broke the home run record when he told a reporter, "It really led to turning me off of baseball, all that he went through. It really made me see a clear picture of what the country is about." Talk a little bit about that, what he did experience.
What he experienced is the American story. He experienced what America tells you to do, which is to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It tells you to work hard and not complain. It tells you to give the best of your ability. And Henry did all of those things. And when he got to the top, what did he receive? He received people trying to kill him, which undermined everything about this meritocracy that we've been told them to believe in. And when you have an FBI detail and you have kidnapping threats to your family just because you're swinging a baseball bat, it makes you look at things a very different way. He always told me this was supposed to be the happiest moment of my life, and it never turned out to be that way. And that's really telling. It's a real indictment. I think people recognized over time that America caught up to Henry, but he was far, far ahead of it back in 1974.
And yet he persevered. He went on to a career afterwards. What was he like as a person that allowed him to do what he did even after his career?
Well, I think he had an enormous amount of confidence in himself, an enormous amount of pride. He understood that his ability was affording him a life that was never going to be available to so many other African Americans. And he felt he had a responsibility to use that talent. One of my favorite stories with Henry was I remember being in his house and we were talking and he was telling me about how he did not want to move to Atlanta when the Milwaukee Braves moved to Atlanta after the 1965 season, because he knew what racism was down there. He knew what Jim Crow was all about. And he ended up having a meeting with Ralph Abernathy and Andrew Young and Martin Luther King Jr. And they told him, when he said, I don't think I'm doing my part for this movement. I'm just a player. And Dr. King told him, you are as important to this movement as we are. You do the things that you do. We need you as much as the rest of the country needs us. And I remember him telling me that he couldn't imagine what life would have been like had he not gone to Atlanta. That put him right in the center of the civil rights movement, and it centered him as a person.
I wonder what he was thinking of where the game is now. I mean, he talked a lot about lamenting that more blacks weren't going into baseball. The openings for managers still were fairly limited. Where are we now? What do you think he thought?
He felt all of those things. You're absolutely right. But I know he was far more concerned about where the country was at. I talked to him 3 weeks ago to wish him a happy new year. One of the things he wanted to talk about was, one, surviving the Trump era. And then also the fact how proud he was of Georgia, that his state, and he and his wife, Billy, very, very deep into Democratic politics there, that they saw some history and that they were in the center of change. I am personally happy that he got to see this thing through.
He saw history. He made history. The life and legacy of Henry Hank Aaron. Howard Bryant, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A cry for racial justice, some 400 years in the making, moves us. The dream of justice for all will be deferred no longer. A cry for survival comes from the planet itself, a cry that can't be any more desperate or any more clear. And now, a rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism, that we must confront and we will defeat. To overcome these challenges, to restore the soul and secure the future of America, requires so much more than words. It requires the most elusive of all things in a democracy: unity. Unity.
The biggest stories, the moment they happen, from around the globe. Subscribe to Bloomberg Quick Take now for insight in an instant.
This service is...
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 23rd, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, suggestions to share. Wow, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Lots to share. We will get to it. I'm getting to get to callers as well. Let's see. Whew. Lengthy list. Number one, Hammerin, Henry Aaron, passing away. I'm not a big baseball fan, so I'm not very knowledgeable about his career on the baseball field or off. That's reading more important than watching television. So I will be looking forward to doing some reading. I've read reports and seen different things where he has talked about racism over the years, including the racism that he experienced when he broke Babe Ruth's home run record. And the threats and everything that he experienced. So very sad to see that he passed away this weekend. But opportunity to learn about racism, white supremacy, the impact that racism had on his life, his response to it. In fact, the letters that he talked about, saving the racist white terrorist letters that he received, the threats and what have you, when he was breaking the home run record. Just that alone would probably reveal a lot about white supremacy, racism, and particularly him doing this in Atlanta. Let's see. I'll share one. It reads, Mr. President. Apparently this race soldier wrote to the president, who at that time would have been Richard Nixon. Writing to President Nixon, why in the name, or I guess it could be the Atlanta Braves baseball president, but it almost seemed like it might have been the president. Anyway, why in the name of hell don't you park you have? That's what it says. That's it. I missed. Why in the name of hell don't you get rid of that Hank Aaron and fill up that ballpark you have? I will bet you 80% of the people in Atlanta don't give a damn for that nigger. When he should be playing, he is sick or hurts, and you fall for it. If you will get rid of some of them niggers and put in white ball players, we can use judgment. We, the white people, don't give a damn for the nigger. Oh, wait a minute. If you get rid of some of the niggers and put in white ball players, we can use judgment. We could win the pennant and fill that park. But as it is, we, the white people, don't give a damn for the nigger lovers and niggers either. Who told you a bunch of niggers can play ball? You are in the South now and don't give a damn for black farts. Now, all in all, don't you think Aaron to be a failure? Home run king his black ass. A has-been fan. August 21, 1972. Not exactly ancient history. Like, this is not, you know, Civil War times, you know, Pitchfork, Ben Tillman. 1972. Dr. King has already been assassinated and everything. Anywho, Jeff Toobin, remember how he was mocking O.J. Simpson's grammar, saying he couldn't spell worth a darn and all the, remember that? Whew, can't even spell should correctly. Anyway, Hank Aaron, victim of white supremacy racism. I'm looking forward to reading, researching, and getting more of those notes. As I said, he saved them. I probably would too. Evidence of the system of white supremacy. Next. The segment. Now, they had lots of reports on what's happening at the Capitol. That's another opportunity to learn, study the system. They have said consistently, in the same manner that many talk about white supremacy, that it's white men, it's white male patriarchy, white male supremacy. You know, that's consistently leaving out white women. You can't have a system without white women. Now, I've seen reports. They're photographs of white women, pictures of white women. One of the white women who died was an insurrectionist. I mean, it was not white men. It was white people, males, females. Now, I have not seen any pictures of black people. If anybody can find a photograph of where one of the insurrectionists was a black person wielding a baseball bat or mace or anything else, I would appreciate checking that out. Who is that person? How did they, you know, make that happen? Please share. But I haven't seen that yet. But Emily Hernandez, she gets all the way from Missouri to Washington, D.C., gets Nancy Pelosi signed and all the rest of it. 20 years old. Linda McGovern, 63 years old, all the way from Connecticut, impersonating an enforcement officer, pulls off after she is asked to stop, not complying. Mr. Fuller, even, what did he say? Don't flee. Nah, forget that. I'm white. I flee if I want to. Fight if I want to. Impersonate an enforcement officer if I want to. We say, badge or no. Did you hear how they described Emily Hernandez and Linda McGovern? They said about Linda McGovern, she is intelligent and smart and brilliant. And oh, she has a crackerjack memory. I don't even know what that means. I guess that's a metaphor, but I don't even know what that means. A crackerjack memory. She is just brilliant. And I mean, she is so just well thought out. She takes so much time to really make a judgment. I mean, she is just smart and intelligent. I said, are we talking about a scientist? Are we talking about somebody who works at MIT? Did I miss something? Is this somebody who could have been one of the insurgents down in Washington, D.C.? Then Emily Hernandez, 20-year-old suspected race soldier, charged terrorist. They said about her, oh, Emily, she knows she did wrong. She wants to put this incident behind her. She's just, you know, she just got caught up. She's the girl next door. Another one. I don't know what that means. Think that's probably a metaphor. The girl next door. This is the white woman who had Nancy Pelosi's sign. The girl next door. On my best day, black people don't describe me as being, oh, that Gus. He's a great fella. He is just the boy next door. Never. The shiftless coon out back. The old dirty bastard. We miss you, black brother, Wu-Tang forever. But that is the description I am accustomed to receiving, not the boy next door, or he's just so smart and intelligent and well thought out and reasoned and just brilliant and so patient. And boy, he just has a crackerjack memory, that Gus. Never. These are people that are charged with crimes. They got that. I don't hear people talk about like President Obama in those type of glowing terms. Even when he was in office, I didn't hear people talk about President Obama. He was another one. No count, shiftless coon. That type of thing. Like, wow. White. No one does it better. White girls do it best. Practicing white supremacy, racism. We're going to talk about that. White women being present and an integral part of the lynch mob. Absolute Emmett Till. All the way to 2021, Emily Hernandez, Linda, 63 years old. What are you doing? Moving forward. Kwame Kilpatrick, recently released. We talked about him before on the program. I feel like we just talked about him recently. It seemed like they wanted to say part of the problem was that he was uppity before we even got to any of his misconduct and all the rest of it, that we have got an uppity Negro in Detroit. I guess the only other thing I'll say on that quickly is, you know, they had folks, they wanted Kwame Kilpatrick to serve the duration of his 28 years, 3 decades, serve it all. You know, let's not half step on this. My apologies. Let's not, you know, go easy. You know, let's get fullest extent of the law. That's how they say it. Is that the tactic that they've taken with Flint? I don't think Kwame Kilpatrick killed anybody or destroyed anyone's health for the duration of their life. That's what happened with Flint. If we're going to hold Kwame Kilpatrick accountable, sure seems like there should be some accountability and like criminal accountability for what happened in the same state. I could be talking crazy. They had the segment, they were talking about Los Angeles and how COVID-19 has had a huge impact and impact on the hospitals and what have you, particularly black non-white people. They mentioned that they don't have adequate funding and that this should cause a shift in, you know, how we think about providing care and the impact of racism, white supremacy, so we can solve some of these problems at a more foundational level. And they said that the types of care that we do now are the worst, the least efficient. They don't solve any problem. It's from diabetes and even pause right there. Things that might be described as health related. Certainly racism, white supremacy is the source of all of these problems. But some of that is certainly could be mitigated at least by what we eat. We did spend some time talking about that earlier this week, really being mindful about what we eat so we can try to minimize some of those health problems. But they said amputations, dialysis, that sort of thing. We talked about that with Dorothy Roberts the very first time she was on the program, 2009. And then again, the third time that she was a guest on the program in 2011, because someone, a caller, asked her about amputations of black people. And she said she found out that that was the only type of service where black people got higher rates of that type of service than any other. All the other types of service, which would not be an amputation, something hopefully that is constructive and is going to be restorative in nature, white people got more. That's how you have opioids and all the rest of it, as they say. But she went, did the research, and then she actually published it in her book that, bing, amputations, then that's not just California. That is throughout the system of white supremacy in the archives. Larry King passed away today. I just made note of that because we have been talking about him so much in the book club. Jeffrey Toobin, The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. He has a whole chapter that we just read, A Visit from Larry King. Larry King goes to the O.J. Simpson trial. He gives O.J. the black power symbol. He tries to shake O.J.'s hand and the guards hop it out. Wait a minute, you can't touch that nigger. Get out of here. He goes, he has a visit with Judge Ito. He interviews almost everyone of significance from the trial, Johnny Cochran and Faye Resnick and F. Lee Bailey, anybody who, you know, was anybody affiliated with the trial. I think they made a brief stop with Larry King. So you can go through, and I think I posted some of the, in fact, O.J. Simpson even called in. He had Johnny Cochran on the Larry King show, I believe the day after the verdict in 1995, and O.J. Simpson called in as well. So yeah, Larry King still suspected racist, but just at this moment for him to pass away. And I think he even will still have more cameo appearances in Jeffrey Toobin's book as we head towards the conclusion. So yeah, Larry King. Let's see, next. I was thinking of Pamela Evans Harris, the late, many time guest on the program. She wanted to help share information from Mr. Fuller and other folks, but talking about Mr. Fuller in this instance. And so she went to put up the website, the Black Code Files, right? We talked about that before. It's got audio segments from Mr. Fuller, different clips from over the years and what have you. And when she was first constructing the site, she was going to call it the Fuller Files, alliteration with the F and all that. And Mr. Fuller was, you know, appreciative, great, get out the information, all that. But he said, it cannot be called Fuller Files. Let's, you know, switch the name up, find some Black Code Files, find our names. Reason he gave, he said, it's not supposed to be focused on Fuller, not supposed to be focused on the person. Follow logic, which is something I think is super important. People make lots of mistakes. Everybody, lots and lots of mistakes. Really put the emphasis on logic. And a lot of times when things get personal, that's where, you know, emotion and that sort of thing can get involved as well. Follow logic, not people. Very important. Let's see. Next. Oh, my goodness. The sharing information. This is one I felt like I should have been saying for a while, but I think it is super important just because so many people have died just because of sharing their views on racism. Not that they tried to storm the Capitol or had a firearm or a weapon, a can of mace, anything. Just talking about the system of white supremacy racism. And they ended up being harmed, sometimes killed. On that basis, and in the effort of striving to be accurate, if we're talking about, let's say, Dr. Welsing, because that's one. Whew, man, I remember when she passed away. It is crazy to think it's been 5 years since she passed away. But I remember shortly after her transition, and there were victims of racism, qualified, but victims. And they were talking and saying, you know, Dr. Welsing passed and she meant so much to me. She had such a huge influence on my understanding of racism and the work that I do, which fantastic. Lots of folks all over the world who can say that truthfully. And then they would pivot right from that to, if any of these bootlicking Uncle Tom 21st century handkerchief head Sambos have the audacity to say an unkind word about Dr. Welsing. I would just think like, wow, I don't. I'm not sure Dr. Welsing would endorse that type of language about black people. I think she managed to say like once or 12 times something about black self-respect. I think she might have agreed with no name calling, if I'm not exaggerating. I think she might have said that once or three times maybe. VGQ. But in my view, if we are going to talk about any victim of racism, white supremacy, we should make an effort to be accurate in what we say about their views or sharing their content or what have you, and to minimally not be hypocritical when we share. Shouldn't be coming out and, yay, right on for Dr. Welsing in one sentence. And then the very next paragraph, Uncle Tom saying Bo Hankerton. I mean, Dr. Welsing, I don't think she would be, yes, I'm so proud. I don't think that would be something where she'd be given a commendation and said, yes, that is black self-respect. That is exactly what I talk about in the ISIS papers. Mm-hmm. Sambo. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. Let's see. Next, we will be here on Tuesday, white guests only. Patrick Dre. I've had this book for quite some time. The book At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America, Philip Dre. I got this book a while back. I think a Cows listener mentioned it, gave it really high reviews, said it's great, lots of constructive information. Started reading it, agreed. It's like, wow, this is really good. And I put it down. It's kind of, it's lengthier. Not, you know, too long, but just lengthier. Sometimes you get, you know, confused, distracted, all types of things. Anyway, we just read Isabel Wilkerson's Cased, second worst book ever. She mentions this book in her text, and the reason is because... All right, got disconnected somehow. I'm back. Let's see. Much obliged for your patience. So, I was saying we'll be here on Tuesday. I think that's the 27th. Philip Dre will be here at the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. I've had the book for some years. I got distracted from finishing it. And I thought of it again. One, Isabel Wilkerson, she mentions this book Encased, that we just read, second worst book ever. Philip Dre uses the term cased in his book. That's one, even though it is still a constructive book. But the other reason I thought of this book is because the mob in D.C., I said that is the whole history of white supremacy, is collective white mob violence. That's Pitchfork, Ben Tillman. That's the Klan. That's their whole time in the known universe. That's how they have, even they brag about it with the Roman Empire. And yes, going to sack the Colosseum and brag about that sort of thing. Love that sort of thing. Philip Dre, that's what Philip Dre's book is all about. That's what's on the cover. Emily Hernandez and coming. In fact, he has two white women at the bottom. They have a black body being hung, and they have two white women, and then they have the mob, you know, to the side or whatever. But At the Hands of Persons Unknown, I thought I would take a moment to read a little bit, and then we'll get to some of the folks who dialed in. So this is on page 77. He writes, on February 3rd, 1893, Ida Wells was in Washington, D.C., at Frederick Douglass's invitation to deliver a speech to an integrated group of reformers when news arrived of a major spectacle lynching at Paris, Texas. A young black man had been burned before a crowd of 10,000 people, one of the largest events of its kind to date. Several days earlier, it was reported 3-year-old Myrtle Vance, the daughter of the local sheriff, had been outraged with demoniacal cruelty and then taken by her heels and torn asunder in the mad wantonness of guerrilla ferocity. The suspected killer, Henry Smith, was a retarded 17-year-old black man. His motive, 17's a man, not anyway. His motive in killing the little girl, it was claimed, was vengeance against the father who had arrested and harassed Smith on previous occasions. As soon as the child's body was discovered, the community had swung into action, and 4 days and nights, 2,000 men scoured the surrounding countryside of northeastern Texas, the railroads providing free passage to the search parties. Imbecile or not, Smith had had sense enough to disappear the moment he heard he was wanted in the case, and when law officers finally caught up with the fugitive, it was at Clough, a hamlet on the Arkansas and Louisiana Railroad, about 20 miles north of Hope, Arkansas. At Texarkana, en route back to Paris, thousands showed up at the depot to catch a glimpse of the man, and there was talk of lynching him on the spot. But speeches were made by leaders of the delegation from Paris, including the district attorney, asking the Texarkanians, texts Arkansans to resist taking action against Smith so that he could be delivered back to the rightful victims of his crimes. Only the year before, Texarkana had roasted Edward Coy before a crowd of 15,000 and the men from Paris whose plans for Henry Smith were no doubt inspired by Texarkana's example were essentially warning their neighbors not to be so ill-mannered as to usurp another town's right to stage and enjoy its own lynching. Back in Paris, word of Smith's capture quickly spread. Hundreds of spectators arrived from the countryside in open buckboards. Others came from as far away as Dallas aboard special excursion trains. The townspeople clearly intended to maximize the event's theatricality and demonstrate that they were capable of putting on a grand show. They had brought to Texas and Pacific Depot a cotton float, a large platform on wheels used for haulage, and placed a chair on top of it as if in anticipation of receiving a visiting dignitary. When Smith arrived, the crowd led him from the train and made him sit on the chair in mockery of a king upon his throne. The float was then drawn by four white horses to the town square, which it circled numerous times so that all might see the most inhuman monster known in current history. As men cursed and gave the rebel yell, women fluttered handkerchiefs and excited children and dogs ran behind. White dog, even, my goodness. The parade then proceeded to an open prairie about 300 yards from the depot where a crude execution platform with steps had been constructed. The word justice had been painted in large white letters across the top. Fathers, men of social and business standing, took their children to teach them how to dispose of Negro criminals. Took their children. A witness recounted of the large expectant crowd, mothers were there too, even women whose culture entitles them to be among the social and intellectual leaders of the town. Smith was transferred from the float to the platform and bound securely, his shirt ripped open from the front. There was a small furnace on the platform with hot irons resting in it. By rights, the father of the murdered child was given the first opportunity to exact his revenge. Sheriff Vance, his brothers-in-law, and his 15-year-old son all in turn poked the captive black man with the irons, which seared the flesh to the bone. Smith screamed, prayed, begged, and cursed his torturer, a newspaper man wrote. When his face was reached, his tongue was silenced by fire, and henceforth he only moaned or gave a cry that echoed over the prairie like the wail of a wild animal. Then his eyes were put out, and not a finger's breadth of his body being unscathed, his executioners gave way. Once the Vance family had left the platform, the barely conscious Smith and the entire platform were soaked in oil and set on fire, and the flames rose up above the prairie in a fierce ball, justice faintly discernible in the inferno. Almost immediately after the scouring of the area, four buttons, teeth, and other mementos began and continued throughout the night. Paris had succeeded in mourning a more dramatic spectacle, mounting a more dramatic spectacle than Texarkana. Indeed, amply covered by the press and photographed, it became one of the most talked about spectacle lynchings of the day. Wells used $150 of the $200 she had earned at her Washington speech to hire Pinkerton detectives to investigate the facts behind the Paris lynching. Based on her experience, Wells wondered if Myrtle Vance was really in the innocent-looking child the newspapers depicted her to be, and she suspected that other details were perhaps not as they had been reported. For one thing, Smith seemed to be a harmless person. The man died protesting his innocence, Wells later wrote. He had no trial, no chance to defend himself, and to this day the world has only the word of his accusers that he committed that terrible crime. For that reason, there will always be doubt to his guilt. There is no doubt whatsoever as to the guilt of those who murdered and tortured and burned alive this victim of their bloodlust. But Wells was disappointed by her inability to gather information about the affair. Instead of interviewing sources firsthand, the Pinkertons dispatched an agent from their Kansas City office who did little more than collect local newspaper accounts of the lynching. Smith was one of 117 blacks whose lynchings were recorded that year. A few days after he was killed, a relative named William Butler was also lynched because whites believed he had known of Smith's whereabouts and had kept the information from the sheriff. Perhaps exhausted by their exertions in lynching Smith, the whites hanged Butler without ado, although some men stayed behind and used his body for target practice. The high degree of ritual seen in the Smith lynching and many others, the use of fire, sacredness of objects associated with the killing, the symbolic taking of trophies of the victims' remains, the sense of celebratory anticipation, and then the lingering importance participants placed on such events all suggest an anthropological basis for viewing lynching as a form of tribal sacrifice. Many observers commented on lynching's ability to clear the air or described it as a kind of painful spasm of community needed in order to regain a feeling of normalcy, and many lynchings did occur in a climate of acute pre-existing racial tensions, a fight between a black and a white, talk of insolence on the part of blacks, Kwame Kilpatrick, competition for jobs, an escalating exchange of insults, or the spread of damaging rumors. Sociologist Orlando Patterson has explained the obsessive ritualized killing of black males in the 1890s by suggesting that the South's dominant fundamentalist Christianity combined with its lost cause ideology to create a belief system in which the black man was perceived as an enemy within Southern society. Let's see. There was one. I thought it connected one more. Oh, there it is. Yeah. Patterson also stresses the suggestion of cannibalistic ritual in lynchings. It cannot be coincidence that the South's most popular outdoor entertainment, the barbecue, in which pigs, cows, or sheep were roasted and served picnic style, was also the term commonly used for the spectacle lynchings of black people. As a cookout, human victims were also butchered and roasted, often with the members of the crowd offering suggestions on technique. The act of castration, a horrifying component of many lynchings, was at least mechanically familiar to most Southern participants, men accustomed to the slaughter of fowl and livestock, and such practices as the gelding of horses. While attendees at lynchings did not take away a plate of food, the experience of having witnessed the event was thought by many incomplete if one did not go home with some piece of cooked human being. And there is much anecdotal evidence of lynch crowds either consuming food and drink while taking part in the execution or retiring in mass immediately afterward for a meal, or in the case of a notorious immolation in Pennsylvania in 1911, ice cream sundaes. Even the victims seemed occasionally to join with the spirit of the occasion. The Negroes met their death with remarkable fortitude, noted a news account of a multiple execution in the turn of the century, Georgia. They sang and drank lemonade and joked with the sheriff. I will stop there, but that is Tuesday. Philip Dre, that is what I was thinking about with the whole Capitol riots. This is the whole history of white people collectively. They brag about it. The mob. Brag about it. They use that as a synonym, talking about gangsters and the Godfather films and all that. But Philip Dre at the hands of persons unknown, Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, on the Cows, white guests only. Speaking of books, President Obama, A Promised Land, bestseller, one of the top sellers of this past year. I'm not going to read it, but I got it. I was checking it out. It did not look constructive, so I moved on. No worries, victim of racism. But I did check. Folks who pay attention to the book club, I normally try to count, you know, word usage that can be revealing. For President Obama, A Promised Land, he uses the word racism exactly 10 times. One of those 10 uses is in the phrase reverse racism. And then just to give comparison, he uses the term democracy 63 times, LGBT 18 times, Trayvon Martin 0 mentions. Just thought that was noteworthy. Victim of racism. We will not be reading A Promised Land in the book club. With that, if folks could take about 5 minutes to share their thoughts, observations, that would be grand. We'll make sure everyone gets at least one opportunity to speak. If you are in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button, that would be great. Just to make sure that everyone does not have to fight with a lot of unnecessary background noise. You can unmute so that you can speak and then mute your line again. That would be awesome. If we could not use metaphors, that would be really appreciated. The metaphors are ubiquitous within the system, frequently used to enforce the system of racism, white supremacy. White people will frequently use analogies, similes to insist that two separate concepts or entities are exactly the same. Frequently, that is not the case at all. That is just master deception. Victims like myself, we've been exposed to this misconduct for a number of years. And many of us are still learning. So sometimes, if we don't have all the logic or we haven't quite picked the correct words to articulate our thoughts, that is fine. Sometimes you need a few more seconds or minutes, even sometimes, to get your thoughts together. No problem. But if we could refrain from using metaphors on this broadcast, if we could speak directly, exactly, be precise with our word choice, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Before we get our listeners, 12 years. I've been stunned. We've been dealing with the Rona and everything else, but it will be a dozen years next month. The COWS has been broadcasting. Hopefully it has been constructive, and especially so right now with all of the problems that we have in the known universe. For a dozen years, listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. You will see my review of Isabel Wilkerson's Caste. That is the most recent post. Why it is the second worst book ever. But also my PayPal button, top right corner. The link for Cash App, cash.app/$TheCows. Enormous gratitude to all of the investors who have kept the COWS broadcasting for a dozen years, hopefully providing accurate, constructive information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works. You can also visit my Amazon wish list under Gus T. Renegade at Amazon.com. Huge thanks to all the folks who have nabbed items. Again, I hope the COWS has provided accurate information to help victims of racism figure out a few things we can do, or maybe many things we can do, to help get this problem solved as soon as possible. That said, let's see. We'll get to the phone lines. We'll get the first few folks who dialed in with a hand up. *61. Again, if you could watch for the background noise, that would be super, super appreciated. Let's see.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings, listeners. Gus, what you just read was very tragic and made me a little bit sick. And it reminds me of Chester Williams, of how we are literally in a invisible war. Well, we aren't, because we know what's going on, but the large majority of non-white black people do not know what's happening. And the segment with the non-white black people suffering in the hospital reminds me of when I was in Skid Row for one of the first times trying to do work over there, and I saw just massive amounts of black people just totally displaced and suffering, and I had never seen anything like that before in my life. It looked like I was like in some sort of apocalypse. But now that I have the insight, oh, this is just racism 101 right there, black people in the worst positions suffering. But thanks for the show. Thanks for what you read earlier. And it was really powerful. But we're really dealing with some really vile things. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Philip Dre should be on the program this Tuesday. Looking forward to it. I think Invisible War, I think that is a metaphor. I would also, I'm just reminded when people invoke the war phrasing, war is being waged against us. Always make sure to say it that way. I think Dr. Kamban shared that when he was on the program some time back. Non-white people are not in war with white people. Not at all. Not even close. Black people are not engaged in war with white people. Not at all. Racists are at war with non-white people. And that is just being mindful of words. That is a very different way of saying, especially not, excuse me, invisible war. Very different than saying white people are at war with black people. White supremacists are at war with black people, non-white people worldwide. Much obliged, sir, for your commentary. Philip Dre, Tuesday. Looking forward. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, let's see. We'll get to you all as well. Hopefully, and I just said, no spectating. Hopefully, folks have a thought or two to share with everything that happened this week. The inauguration, not sure if folks heard Joe Biden. He said white supremacy will be defeated, must be defeated. Wow, I can retire, hang up the headset, and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, they have got this thing. They are dealing with white supremacy, and yeah, we should have this problem, you know, all wrapped up by the halfway point. Should be about 2 years and no more to do, right? I suspect this has probably been the first time ever where a president, minutes, seconds after being sworn in, stands up and says something about white supremacy. I mean, who else does such a thing? What a swing to go from Donald Trump to that. Like, wow. Confusion. Mass confusion. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So the news, the clippings, the clips, they were great. I heard of whoever the baseball player, his name was Hank. I heard of him because I remember MC Hammer really liked him. I think MC Hammer, I know he liked baseball. I just so that's how I heard of him, and I think it's so cool that he kept the letters that those races sent him as reference. I wonder how that'll play out. I do notice that they're not mentioning that he had the received that that injection for the COVID virus a week before he transitioned, and also oh dear, what else is going on? That caught my ear. Oh dear. Okay, brain freeze. So since that was the last one that happened, I remember that, and I can't remember anything else because of all the commentary. But it's okay. I'll mute my line and let you take it. And if I get time, I'll chime in on whatever else I have to say.
Much obliged, Bay Area mom. System of racism can impact memory. Like, I'm not, you know, trying to be funny. Like, they have studies and reports on that type of thing. They have a report. This is from Newsweek, published earlier today. Health professionals hope Hank Aaron's death won't deter people from getting vaccinated. About 2 weeks before his death on Friday at 86 years old, baseball legend Hank Aaron, I think they did say he preferred Henry, but Henry Aaron was among a group of civil rights icons to receive a COVID-19 vaccine in Atlanta. In the immediate aftermath, health experts hope that the loss of the home run king doesn't deter people from getting vaccinated. Aaron received his first dose at the Moderna of the Moderna vaccine on January 5 during a widely publicized event. Besides Aaron, civil rights activists Andrew Young, Zarona Clayton, Joy Beasley, and others also received the vaccine. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms also attended the event. She got terrorized early this year for trying to suggest that people wear masks and social distance. I'll stop there. It goes on just telling about Mr. Aaron encouraging folks to take the virus seriously and to, you know, wear their mask, distance, all that. But yes, people are concerned about that. If people might think this had something to do with Mr. Aaron's passing. I am not sure exactly the details of what he passed away from. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see more details in terms of what the actual complications were for his passing. But much obliged, our Bay Area mom. Let us know, I guess, if you remember the other portion of what you were going to share, and we'll see if we can get that in before we conclude. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
I'm going on the air. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. You're on the air. Retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings. I didn't know you heard that. greetings, everyone. Greetings, Gus. Henry Aaron, one of my favorite professional athletes. A lot of things that people would say they would want their professional athletes to do or contribute towards if when they're not on their field of play. Mr. Aaron was doing that 40, 50 years ago. He actually dropped out of school as a teenager. He was so confident of his abilities to play professional baseball, and he wasn't a big man, but he was, you know, quite skilled in the art of not just hitting the ball, but doing the other things that is required to be a top professional athlete in the sport of baseball. He contributed, as I recall, millions of dollars towards the assistance of young black people. As well as with, I believe, historical black colleges, he did. And he was in the major leagues for at least 22 years during that time. The death threats that he received was on the magnitude at one point in time, almost like Dr. King. You know, as far as, you know, when he was reigning close to a quote unquote record that was already controversial in itself with Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth was not playing against the top players in the world. And he wasn't playing with them because they were black males and they didn't want white males did not want black males to play with them in the major leagues again until 1947 when they started with Jackie Roosevelt Robinson. DCS program. We had another session today. We're coming down to the end with this group. So I basically had to adjust the chronologically the eyes on the prior series, and I kind of like gave an explanation primarily the guys you know, knew on what they were looking at, because we would talk about it after we watched a 20-minute segment of each of the different parts of the series. And we talked about the strategies that were utilized as far as attempting to neutralize the system of racist white supremacy, at least the thought was in this part of the world. Anyway, and now we're moving on to, we actually watched the Eyes on the Prize series analysis of Minister Malcolm X. We watched that, which we know had a different strategy as opposed to the SCLC and SNCC at that time. I kind of like wanted, took the option of mentioning a statement that John Lewis made about Malcolm X, and also stating about the idea that they weren't people in the quote-unquote southern part of this part of the world that's called the concept United States, that most of us, all of us, were primarily fashioned on the idea of nonviolence. And I basically mentioned to the guys about the Deacons for Defense, and there were several other non-white black groups who did not utilize nonviolence as a, basically as almost like a way of life in a sense. They did have other strategies other than just nonviolence to correct them on that. And it was a constructive hours that we had today, and that's my report. Thank you.
Awesome to hear, retired firefighter. If I may ask really quick, you all did all that constructive viewing and got some great dialogue. If you all ate anything, what sort of food items did you all eat?
Basically, Mr. Clark have for them when they show up around 9 o'clock, we have some fruit juice, different types of fruit juice, orange juice, lemonade, and maybe something like maybe not a Danish, but something like blueberry muffins or something like that. Basically later on in the around lunchtime, what is traditionally called lunchtime, they just had some hamburgers and hot dogs. That's primarily it. Yeah.
I was curious. I know retired firefighter, he was with us at our counter-racist yoga retreat in Florida and talking about food. I was curious what the young folks were consuming, if you all were doing any vittles at all. And yeah, that is always trying to whisper that. I know it can be, because you got
yeah, so we have been so long. I think I understand, you know, the whole idea that you may would like the idea of them, you know, having more of a vegan type of situation, but there are some complications that goes along with that. I wouldn't say it's just a money issue. It probably would have something to do with the deal with the parents and what they're used to giving their children. That's, you know, we have to negotiate with them, so to speak.
I am sure that food one is a big deal, and what people are accustomed to, and it could be lots of things, like you were saying, finances and
right,
all that. But I do try and whisper it, especially for like hot dogs, because that one is like processed and all kinds of I don't think too many good things are going to happen from eating hot dogs. Like, to try to be mindful, those eating habits start at a young age. But always great to hear about the efforts with the DCS program, Mr. Clark. Constructive effort helping out young black people down in Florida, especially we were talking about young black children who probably dealing with all the stress from the Rona and everything else, to get some young black people who can come out, hang out, have constructive contact, and get something to eat, talk about racism, white supremacy. Like, man, they could be stuck at home watching TV or some other nonsense. Thought I heard someone. I just wanted to get in really quick. We had one of our female listeners. She messaged me, I think I said earlier, if anybody can find, because I have not seen any reports of a black person who participated in the treasonous violence at the Capitol. She sent me a report. This is at CBS News. Man accused of beating officers with bat during Capitol riot said he wasn't there for Trump. And this is, I'll just read a little bit. A Maryland man who allegedly hit police officers with a bat during the U.S. Capitol riots said on the day of the assault that he was not here for Trump, CBS Baltimore reports. According to the arrest warrant, Emmanuel Jackson was among the violent mob that stormed the Capitol building on January 6th. At around 2 p.m., rioters climbed the steps of the Capitol building near the Senate wing and began to strike windows and doors. Jackson, 20, turned himself into authorities on Monday and had his initial court appearance on Tuesday. Jackson was seen on video surveillance footage making a fist and repeatedly striking U.S. Capitol police officer while he tried to enter the building. He was one of the first people to enter the building, federal authorities said. Jackson was interviewed the day of the riot, and the video was posted to Twitter. I had a bat. They were pepper spraying people. Then they got me in the eye. Asked why he was there, Jackson replied, "Fighting for America. We've been taken over by globalists, by the Chinese. Fighting for America. I'm not here for Trump. I'm here for America." Well, he said what he said. I think I've said pretty consistently not to be out and about in this fracas. I would have been terrified to be a black person in the middle of all of that. Like, I don't even know how you begin to assure them, like, I'm with you all, like, make sure we don't get confused, like, damn Obama, damn Al Sharpton, like, I wouldn't even know, like, how do you, you know, make sure I'm with you, my white brothers, I'm with you, they stole the election, I'm here, make America great again. Like, whatever slogan that you need to say, or if you need to wear, he has on, it looks like a black hooded sweatshirt. Like I said, Trayvon Martin already, like, woof, I don't know. Man, we'll have to see. Let's give you his name again. Emmanuel Jackson, 20-year-old, black male. So we'll have to see. The listener who shared this report says, what did I say before? Fullest extent of the law. Those white women that I mentioned before, Emily Hernandez and Linda McGovern, I don't think they're gonna, he's the boy next door. he's just the kindest, most smart and intelligent and patient and well thought out black boy you could, no, I don't think that's gonna happen. I could be totally wrong. Number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Blue, who is also with us for the Florida retreat.
Greetings, guests. Greetings to all the guests. Thank you very much for the show tonight. Just a few things. One for the retired firefighter. There is a wonderful Netflix documentary or documentary on Netflix. It's called What the Health? And it really, it says a lot of things. It's done by a white, so-called white male, but it really talks about a lot of things that Tracy McGuire talks about in her book, By Any Means Necessary, about eating healthy, and a lot of information about how diseases can be changed and overcome through plant-based diets. I am rereading By Any Means Necessary, and it is helping me a lot with staying on and being dedicated to eating vegan with a lot of healthy meals inside her book, but with the documentary might be something that he could show the young men and maybe even the parents, everyone could look at it and maybe they could have a movie night and be something that they could all share and think about and talk about. In reference to some of the things that were some of the news reports tonight, I did watch some of the inauguration and did hear President, so-called President Joe Biden, speak and make his promises to the American public about ending white supremacy and beating it down, as so-called. And when I spoke to a lot of non-white black people and non-white brown or so-called Hispanic people afterwards on Facebook or either by the phone, I realized that a lot of people are very confused with what's going on because of a lot of the racial profiling that was exhibited on that day with the poet Amanda Gorman, I think her name is, and with many things that were said, with a lot of the appointments that Joe Biden is making to his cabinet. I am learning just through conversation that a lot of non-white people are very confused at what's going on. A lot of non-white people are considering getting the vaccination, even with the passing of Henry Aaron several weeks after receiving his vaccination, and even with reports globally around the world, like in Norway, with vaccinations being administered to nursing home patients, and about 23 or so nursing home patients passed away after being administered the vaccination in Norway, which is a pretty recent report. It happened in December, but it's coming out in different news applications online. And even with that information, still a lot of non-white people are committed to taking the vaccination. And so I just had a lot of conversations this week after the inauguration, and I noticed that there was a lot of confusion, particularly with the racial showcasing that was happening during the inauguration. And I'll meet my line. I don't, if I have anything else to say, maybe I'll remember at the end. But once again, for retired firefighter, the documentary on Netflix is called What the Health, and it does mirror a lot of the information that Tracy Lynn McQuire puts in her book, By Any Means Necessary. And maybe it might be more palatable for them to look at it because a white male is disseminating the information, but there are a lot of different doctors and even some non-white doctors on there that talk about the benefits of a plant-based diet. And for 2021, that is my firm commitment to eat more plant-based meals, and I've been cooking a lot more. And Gus, if there's any way to get more recipes from you, especially for the sweets, so that I could provide those for my mom and other family members, sweet potato pie and the cookies, if there's any links or anything that I can look up for those recipes, I'd really appreciate that. Thank you, and I'm meeting my line, and I hope everyone stays safe and healthy.
Much obliged. Dr. Ruby Lathan, she is also one of the stars in What the Health, and she's been a guest on the program many, many times throughout the years. Now, even, well, I can't say this year anymore. Last year, she was with us last year, though, even several times, and was talking about the importance of eating correctly, even after the Rona, saying it should be even more emphasized, and saying she was having people reaching out to her and wanting to do better to take care of themselves. Because, you know, health, so much focus on health. So that might be. And I love the suggestion with the children and the parents to be able to watch the film and maybe rethink some of their eating options. And I felt so bad. Chef Nadira from the Cows Counter Racist Yoga Retreats, she would not be pleased. Like, man, we had amazing carrot hot. In fact, both of the victims you just heard enjoyed amazing carrot hot dogs. Carrot hot dogs are substantially less expensive than regular hot dogs. Better for you and super tasty. And both of the folks who just talk know this. So it does not have to be expensive. And I've seen non-white children love. I've seen non-white children and so-called adults love some carrot hot dogs. They are super. I was just thinking myself, like, I need to get extra carrots so that I can make some carrot hot dogs. I have not had them in a while, but you can grill them. You can have chili cheese dog. I have photographs, everything. Speaking of photographs, so for the dessert portion, if you go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/ The Problem Is White People. I guess since people have been saying, Gus, you should do a counter-racist cookbook, and I've been very resistant to doing this for some reason. So if you go to my Facebook page and look, the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, at least 5 of the most recent posts are all desserts. So, and actually one of them is breakfast that I didn't count, but I mean, it's blueberry, homemade blueberry sauce with walnut pancakes, all vegan. So that's kind of close to the dessert realm. Pancake Sunday is always amazing at Gus T's house. Blueberry sauce with walnut pancakes. So the next dessert was the red velvet cake. We were going to have that at the retreat in Toronto. The border is still closed. The red velvet cake, amazing. I hadn't had red velvet cake in a very long time. Vegan. It's springy, moist. I don't think people would know the difference. The best dessert of 2020, the lemon velvet cake. I didn't even know that the velvet cake series, that's a whole series, that they have like the lemon velvet and the red velvet and the orange velvet. I think there's a caramel velvet. Like, it's, I had no idea. I just only had the red velvet. I made the lemon velvet. That is the best cake I've ever had in my life. I would fight family members. Like, whew, it was amazing. Best cake I have ever had. Lemon velvet cake. It's vegan. The lemon, just the icing is, I'm someone who didn't even like a lot of icing when I was not vegan. The ice, you will lick the icing off the knife. Absolutely amazing. The best dessert that I had in the entire 2020. I made salted caramel pecan cinnamon rolls. That is the second best dessert of the year. Takes a lot more effort. That's like an all day task because it's a lot with the dough and everything, but so worth it. The salted pecans, it's got the melted. The pictures for all of this is on my Facebook page, so you can see the yumminess. But the salted caramel pecan cinnamon rolls, the pecans are even better if you toast and salt them. They're even letter grade boost. Pumpkin pie, absolutely amazing. It's like a little forkful of magic metaphor, but I don't know how else to describe it. It's beyond words. It was so good. I made pecan pie. That was also really, really good. I think both of those, you could totally fool people and not even tell them it's vegan until they finish and be like, oh yeah, that was vegan. Let's see. Those are not desserts. I made sweet potato casserole with melted marshmallows and a pecan crumble on top. Out of control. Delicious. Chocolate chip cookies. I think that's enough desserts. There are other desserts. There's chocolate peanut butter ice cream, banana pudding. There are lots of desserts there. That's enough. Oh, there's pineapple upside down cake. We had that at the, that was really, really good. The pineapple upside. So there you go. Go to the blog, facebook.com, the problem is white people, and just go to photos and go to my pictures, and you can just scroll through and pick out the desserts from 2020. And yeah, I've been saying that the whole time. There's no reason at all you should miss out on any desserts at all. Like, absolutely nothing. Not ice cream, not pie, not cake, not cinnamon rolls, not cookies. Absolutely nothing. I have sweet potato pie right now. I just mentioned that yesterday. Like, the power went off and I literally had a sweet potato pie in the oven. The power came back on. I resurrected it and the pie was amazing. Like, even power outage could not stop the vegan sweet potato pie. I didn't even put a picture of that up, but yeah, no shortage of vegan dessert ideas at Gus T's place. Let's see. Other folks. Oh, Mr. Blue, yes, sir.
The problem is white people. That is the Facebook page.
Yep. Facebook.com/theproblemiswhitepeople.
Thank you so much. And me and Miss Kai have also been experimenting with the vegan lasagna. The family does not know the difference. Thank you very much for that one. And we just recently said that we're going to do the carrot hot dog, just for my mom as well, and for our optimal health as well. And so that's something we're going to try too. And it's all very inexpensive. Even the vegan lasagna is the ingredients, no more than $20. And we have a meal that can last for days. So thank you very much. And to all the guests, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I made lemon bars too. I was just looking through the rest of the year. No shortage of dessert ideas. I love it. The lasagna. We had lasagna in Florida with retired firefighter veggie lasagna. That was good. The vegan lasagna that I made in D.C. was even better. Pictures of that are on my blog as well. But yeah, you can do all of this and you do not have to spend a lot of money. Like, that's something that we tried to emphasize at the retreats. And I think Dr. Lathan talks about that. Like, you really do not have to spend tons of money, even for the lot of the desserts and things that I just mentioned. Like, none of this stuff really costs like a lot of money to make. It starts to cost a lot of money. And when you go to like Whole Foods and those expensive, upper end white grocery stores, and buy the vegan cinnamon roll there or the vegan pecan, then it's going to be like $50 for a slice. Then it'll be really expensive. But I mean, if you get these ingredients and make them yourself, not very expensive at all. I mean, you can get like organic everything and it still will not be very expensive at all. And it will be better for you. Outstanding all the way. Anywho. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I forgot. I just made walnut chocolate brownies. I didn't even put those on the blog. Those were amazing as well. And a lot of this stuff, I totally suspect. We didn't have as many people with us, but that banana pudding, I think you would totally fool people. They wouldn't even know that, you know, this is non-dairy. It would just be banana pudding. That's amazing. Same thing, the sweet potato pie. It would just be sweet potato pie that is amazing that just happens to be non-dairy. Yeah, tons of ideas. Eat well, be healthy. Let's see. Other folks, commentary.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Good evening, Gus. Sounds good. Walnut brownies. Rest in peace to Hank Aaron. He breaks the home run record after a year of receiving racist threatening mail and messages because white people didn't want a black male to break the coveted record that Babe Ruth owned. Death threats, pictures of gorillas, the usual tackiness to expect from white supremacists. And he kept it all, and he made it known that he was being threatened and harassed. So he hits the home run to break the record, and as he rounds second base, two white people run up on him. follow him, one even touches him. No security. These people could have killed him, you know, just to show, you know, how white supremacists do. Good riddance to Larry King. How do you perform over 30,000 interviews in the United States of America, 99% of them with white people, and you almost never bring up racism, you never challenge the known racist? He was useless. Kilpatrick's release, Lil Wayne, Kodak Black, Carrie O. I'm always glad to see black people get out of jail. White people made a big deal out of these few black people who got released, but he released 116 people on that same day. They didn't mention all of the white degenerates that he released. I think white people were angry about not getting their way, getting their results they wanted. So they stormed the Capitol. I don't think they did it out of racism. I think if that was the case, they would have had a plethora of black people to choose from in Washington, D.C., outside of the Capitol area. The Capitol Police has officially become the nation's most incompetent police force, which is hard to do. Some police were doing their job, risking their lives to uphold their duty. Others were posing and pleading with criminals in the middle of a criminal act. Total incompetence. Remember the response of the police union and the police officers here snitching. Breaking the proverbial blue wall of silence. Next time an unarmed black person gets gunned down by the police, they say they can't force the police officers to fire the police officer to be fired because of the union and the municipal contract. Yeah, it didn't seem like that's a problem now. Next time police say they can't tell on another cop, it seems like a lot of cops are telling on other cops here. Seems like they just can't tell when it's succumbed to abusing black people. They got over 1 million military personnel in the United States, over 1 million federal employees, and they said they don't have the manpower to check the social media of the military to find out if they were at the Capitol in the form of insurrection. All they have to do is look up everyone whose cell phone pinged in the Capitol, try to connect to the Capitol's Wi-Fi. All the cell phones that were pinging off each other, just using the GPS location, they've made less than 200 arrests. I've seen thousands of people inside that building. That's impossible. And they're undercharging these white people under the burglary law. Using any amount of force to enter a building constitutes breaking an entry. That's a felony. Charge them with breaking an entry. Stealing something during a break in an entry, that's called armed robbery. That's a big felony. Charge those who stole stuff with armed robbery. The girl who stole Pelosi's laptop and attempted to sell it to Russia, straight to Guantanamo Bay, that's espionage. Take pictures of paperwork, stealing documents, opening senators and congressmen's desks, entering their offices, that's espionage. Military tribunals. Don't even send them to court. The police officers, the Capitol Police participating, the active soldiers, National Guard, ex-soldiers, public officials, anyone who took an oath to uphold the Constitution and went into that building, treason. People who built the gallows and the scaffolds to hang and behead public officials, that's intent to commit harm, at the very least murder. When they built the gallows, that was first degree intent because they stood there on the Capitol grounds and built it. They charged black people with intent to sell drugs all the time simply because it's in bags around. But they don't do this to white people who's attempting to kill Congress people. And lastly, did y'all see the fine craftsmanship and masonry that our ancestors, who were slaves at the time, white people stood there all looking at all the stuff that we once built. And I just thought that was very interesting.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I said that last week, Guantanamo Bay. I've been using that word treason. Like they've been saying insurrection and all the rest of it. I think this is treason. Isn't that what this is? Like, I mean, you're trying to subvert lawfully elected government officials? Isn't that treason? Like, that should be some, you know, heavy charges. Like, let's get to it. Where's Homeland Security? Like, white women not sitting around talking about, oh, Emily Hernandez is just the girl next door. Oh, Linda McGovern is smart, intelligent, wise, patient, genius, really. In fact, compare what they said about her. That's what I meant. Henry Aaron, excuse me. Listen to what they said about Henry Aaron. Aaron faced racism of the Deep South, metaphor there, while winning the South Atlantic League's MVP award with Jacksonville as a 19-year-old in 1953. And when Aaron was a shy rookie with the Braves in 1954, manager Charlie Grimm reportedly nicknamed him Step and Fetch It, a vaudeville comedian billed as the laziest man in the world. Emily Hernandez and Linda McGovern storming the White House are smart, intelligent, the girl next door. Henry Aaron, 19 years old, coming in to win the MVP, is the laziest man in the world. Other folks who have commentary to share, we missed you totally. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. rest in peace to Henry Hank Aaron. It was interesting. he's probably one of my all-time favorite baseball players. And also, too, I read some of those letters that was actually published as well in regards to his breaking Babe Ruth's home run record. I remember watching interviews with Aaron and him saying that he didn't really take much pleasure in breaking the record because of the fact that, you know, this white terrorism that he had to deal with in regards to, you know, breaking the record. So, you know, not only threatening his life, but also because he also had a daughter during that time who was in college. There was also, you know, talks about kidnapping her as well. So, you know, he had to deal with that. So, he always said that he didn't take a lot of pleasure in it because of the fact that he was, you know, kind of dealing with all that. And it was just a, you know, relief that he broke it. And, you know, it was like nothing happened after that. But, you know, it's... something, you know, something to look at when you look at how he talks about, you know, not taking pleasure in breaking that home run record. So Henry Aaron from Mobile, Alabama. I think also Satchel Paige is from Mobile, Alabama as well. So, you know, two baseball players that, you know, both faced both victims of racism. Henry Aaron also one of the last Negro League baseball players, along with Willie Mays, after they left, you know, the Negro Leagues had to shut down a couple of years later. They were kind of like their last two stars, and the record that Henry Aaron broke, Babe Ruth, you know. There's always been question about, you know, if he was white or not. A couple of years ago, I was reading an article about a sports writer. I think his name was Fred Lieb, a white guy, back in the 20s or 30s, who quoted Ty Cobb calling Babe Ruth a nigger because I guess he had some kind of, I don't know, he had some sort of non-white parent or, you know, ancestor in his lineage. But, you know, one of the things I just wanted to ask, what constitutes a white person? Because, I mean, I always thought that Babe Ruth was a white person, but, you know, with Ty Cobb, who was a, you know, racist himself, you know, he called Babe Ruth a nigga. So, you know, what constitutes a white person? And who says that, you know, a white person is, you know, a person is white? So, you know, that's probably a question I, you know, might want to throw out there. But that's all I have on my line.
Much obliged. Henry in Chicago. My answer, the most powerful racist white supremacists, they decide who is a white person, what those qualifications are, and they can change it as they go. And I think to be accepted as a white person, I think you just have to have a substantial number of other individuals who are classified as accepted as white say that, yes, we think that this person is white. It seems like that is enough to have you, you know, a certified member of the white race. But again, they do make it up, change it as they go. This is not based on biology or anything of that nature. This is all, you know, what we say it is. We being racist man, racist woman. And again, as the most powerful racists, I think they get to decide what that means. And just having enough individuals classified, accepted as white, say that, yes, we will accept Babe Ruth as white. Or no, we do not. Folks can give their response. Let's see. Folks that we've missed completely. If you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed.
Oh, hi. This is the victim from Canada. Hi, Gus, and all of the call listeners. I think after the caller just mentioned, it's all about racial classifications. And then in Mr. Fuller's book, he always says that there's only three types of people in the known universe, and that is white, non-white, and white supremacists. And in order to keep us from becoming confused non-white people, it's really important for us to just stick to those three classifications, Hispanic is not a color, nor is it a racial classification. It's more or less a title. And these words do cause non-white people to be confused. And it's just really important to stick with those three racial classifications. And so that one of the main reasons to stick to those three racial classifications is to avoid becoming confused. And when you're dealing with other non-white people, it's, you know, you can ask them questions. You know, I forget what's the codified question to ask another non-white person, but maybe Gus can go into that. I mean, usually you ask them, do you identify yourself as white or non-white? And then I guess depending who you're talking to, if it's a white supremacist who's pretending to be a non-white person to deceive a non-white person or to get a non-white person to do something against another non-white person, and if they don't tell the truth, you know, white supremacists are people who don't want truth to be revealed. So, and they use deception as a means to deception in the form of indirect violence. There's two types of violence. There's direct violence when someone hits you or does harm to you. And then there's indirect violence when someone tries to deceive you, and that's deception. And typically what the white supremacists tend to do is they tend to like to pretend to be a non-white person. Or if a non-white person is confused about what they are, you know, it causes conflicts among other non-white people. And deception is one of their main tools for practicing racism. So I also want to add in the beginning of the show, well, at the end of the recording, when Biden says that he wants to fight white supremacy, One of the things when refined, suspect the white supremacists speak, which I classify him as one, you might ask me, why do you suspect that? Because I suspect that, and I'm a non-white person. So I suspect that he could be a refined, suspected white supremacist. So when he uses the word white supremacist, you have to ask him personally. Under codification, it's always best to ask the person who said what they said and ask them what the meaning. What do you mean, white supremacist? And that would mean in any area of activity, whether it be law, labor, politics, sex, religion, entertainment, war, and education, economics, politics, and all the other nine areas. So I guess some of the things that Mr. Fuller says is stay in the question lane and try to, as far as with questions and answers, Mr. Fuller's position, from what I've read in his book, is that all problems can be solved through the process of questions and answers. So one of his ideas is that the best way to know that you have a right answer to a question
30 seconds.
Is by the constructive. Thank you, sir. One of the best ways to decide if you have the right answer to your question is by the constructive result. Everything is constructive, non-constructive, and there's nothing in between. And you have to see what the result is in order for it to be constructive or non-constructive. Thank you very much. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, victim in Canada. Folks that we missed totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Have you heard?
Caller in Florida, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Just a few things on the white people being pursued, that they're calling insurrectionists. And I noticed that the term, I don't know if anyone else has examined that, they're using extremism or domestic extremists or something, like they're trying to get away from using white supremacy. I wonder if that's some kind of act of racism as well. And the segment where I guess they were interviewing someone that's affiliated with law enforcement, he said he went into speaking comfortably, which is what I expect, saying that, well, some of the rioters or the people that they say stormed or breached, I guess, the Capitol were former, I guess, law enforcement, firefighters, and people that were in the service, military. If they had a view that black people are subhuman, I think. I don't know if that is that what he said, Gus?
Yes, he did.
It was a white person?
Yes, he did.
I mean, he sounded kind of comfortable. Like, so I noticed that, and I've talked to white people on the job that'll speak like they're speaking for another white person, but I'm thinking, like, hold on. The term racist suspect does make sense, or just a white supremacist to me automatically, you know. If they acted on those views or they didn't, I think that's what he said too. So it's like no wonder that you have a lot of these Trump supporters be activated like that. It was one guy, I guess they said he was affiliated with a group called Cowboys for Trump. He was like, you know, we'll be back up here. I'm paraphrasing, of course, we'll be back up here and if we don't get what we deserve or we don't get what we're asking for, there's going to be blood on the steps. So very violent intentions, things like that. And the white woman
entitlement, like they're not hiding their faces or nothing. Another white woman that you were speaking about treason, the smug, kind of, you know, arrogant, evil look on the mugshot. Like, yeah, I did it. Like, what? Like, I don't expect to get in trouble. And one white woman is saying, well, hey, I was just trying to follow my president or the President Trump. I didn't know it was going to lead to this. And just trying to claim ignorance. And they have people that look like them that control the media to help them get out of it. So, and I also want to add in that white defiance that I know that you were speaking about, not wearing a mask, following the rules. So it pretty much all connects. And white people are to blame. And that's all I have to share. Thank you.
Much obliged, sir. I did think that that was significant when they spoke with that enforcement official and they were asking him about how do you vet officers to make sure that you don't have, they not white supremacists, but extremists and right wingers on the force. It's, well, you know, someone, let's just say that they think that black people are subhuman and think that black people aren't deserving of the air we breathe. I just thought, like, wow, that's, most people would just say someone who has racist views. I mean, that's like, wow. I mean, that is a level of specificity. Like, okay, much obliged. I don't know if you have those views or not, but wow, thank you kindly. Very direct with things. Let's see, folks that we missed totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm glad you got the email. And there's also another person. I don't know. Whatever about going on. His name is Ali Alexander, and he's black and Arab. That's what he says. And they talked about him, but once they realized that he had connections with politicians, because he was like, I contacted them about starting this Stop the Steal and blah, blah, blah. They kind of stopped talking about him as much because he had evidence that he had contacted white Congress people to help him with the protests and all that. I don't think he got arrested because he said he wanted it to be peaceful. And from the pictures, I didn't see where he was anywhere near the storming and the riotous activity. But yeah, that's two black people. Then there was, I was looking, because I've been looking at the footage. There was one lady, but I don't think they call her. But you know they're going to catch the black people. They are going to look for them, because they can't all be them, even though it probably is. Thank you.
Fullest extent of the law. That's what I suspect for anyone even looks like they might be classified as black. If they get to say, oh, there, this was not exclusively white treasonous activity. There were some dark people here, too. Oh, yeah, they will be on court TV and all the rest of it to make sure that we are aware. Yes, there were lots of people. This was not just white terrorism and white treasonous activity in D.C. Our Bay Area mom, did you get your thought?
Thank you. Yes, I didn't take notes. I was coloring.
So, Kwame Kilpatrick, I'm wondering, I really enjoyed him as being the mayor. It was great, a great visual. Maybe that's what it was for. I wonder what the pardon will cost. I wonder what he's going to have to do since he was on the pardon list. I wonder what the catch would be. The ladies, the white women that they were describing, these innocent white women, I did find it interesting the words that they always use when they're describing their own. And when you're really good, they call you Cracker Jack. So that's what I got when I heard them say, because I've eaten a lot of Cracker Jacks. an only child. So when you're really good, they call you Cracker Jack. So she was really good. Reparations. I'm wondering with Biden, and he's using these code words, because it seems like there are a lot of code words to make us believe that he still might have our best interest in mind with replacing white supremacy with justice. So he's using these words as far as getting rid of white supremacy. I've heard something about reparations. I don't know if that's what the Black Lives Matter want, and they had a list of different things that they wanted. I don't know how they're connected to us, but I noticed that Biden is using a lot of tricky words that I don't believe he's going to stand by, but it keeps us with hope. And maybe in order to get something out of him, he's going to have us do that experimental biological agent that they're putting in those needles in order for us to get a stimulus, and maybe that'll be our repair or reparations. And thank you for coming back to me, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Bay Area mom. She enjoyed Kwame Kilpatrick all the way from California. I guess he did get a lot of national attention. You know, he was an important figure for a while out in the Midwest, Mr. Kilpatrick. I know one thing, he did get released, but they, President Trump said that he still has to pay restitution. I believe it's in the millions. So I don't know if there's anything in addition, but he, you know, still has a hefty debt to pay. In fact, that's the sort of thing in Florida where you can't vote, Mr. Kilpatrick. You might be released from greater confinement. You will not be casting any ballots until you have paid everything back. So, yeah, we'll have more to say about all of that. We should be here on Tuesday. Philip Trey, At the Hands of Persons Unknown. Almost every element of what took place in D.C. is in his book. White women being integral in the participation of this, and then even maintaining their innocence and victimhood at the same time. White women, participation of white veterans. In many instances, it would be white Civil War veterans who lots of expertise, and they had their sometimes whole brigades and everything would go out to terrorize black people. Just so many of the exact same components of what we saw. Upset about the elections, I don't like the results, or is too many niggers voting, or whatever it is, reason to go out, white mob violence against niggers and or nigger lovers. Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Philip Trey. Eat more veggies. That cookbook, I guess I have to give some. I really like, you know, was hesitant, and I just was not interested. I've never thought of myself as like a cook, much less like a vegan cook. But facebook.com/ The Problem Is White People. If you look at the pictures, it's just food. There's not any other activities. Like, it's just food and food and food and food. So maybe we'll do the cookbook and include some desserts. There's lots of ways that you can eat really healthy, really delicious food so that you can always be excited for mealtime and, you know, just having really amazing, healthy and plant-based meals for dessert, for breakfast, dinner, whatever it is. And exposing this to children, I think so important. Anybody, if you work with children, see if you can make that a part of whatever program or effort that you are doing. Like, let's see if we can do better than hot dogs. Not picking on anyone, just saying. I'm going to see if we can, you know, no hot dogs, no potato chips, you know. We're going to see if we can get them to eat a little bit better and to start the foundations to having better eating habits, because they can be so I ate a lot. This is someone, Gus T, I said before, I'm not looking down on anybody with food. I subsisted off of 7-Eleven hot dogs for like years. So I'm not looking down. But if someone had grabbed me, put that hot dog down. You do not want to have to lose all that weight. Put that hot dog back. I'm going to go get real food. Matter of fact, carrot. We're going to go get carrots. If you want the hot dog, we will get carrots and do it up. You can have carrot hot dogs, and we'll figure out, you know, another side to go with that. All the rest. I'm making ranch dressing. I was so excited. That power outage yesterday, I was so excited. I was going to make homemade ranch dressing, and I had my whole dinner idea together, and then the power went out, so I couldn't do anything but homemade ranch dressing, sweet potato pie in the refrigerator, lots of delicious plant-based eating. Dr. Ruby Lathan, What the Health, Tracy Lynn McQuarta. We've had lots of folks on. Even our guest this week, Dotsie Bouch, suspected race soldier, was saying, what is she, her Welsing moment of the week. It is not normal to consume dairy. Normal humans don't consume milk, dairy products. That was Dr. Welsing moment of the week on Dr. King's holiday, no less. We'll wrap up there. Much obliged to folks for participating. Again, hope it was worthy of your time and energy for this Saturday evening. We will be here Tuesday. I guess you can just check updates, Facebook, Twitter, all the rest. If something changes, if we have any programs that are not scheduled, not planned before Tuesday. With that, thank you kindly. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We will need our brain computer working at maximum efficiency to solve the numerous problems we have. In addition to being sober, I'm still saying hunker down. I do not think the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, I don't think they are done. Persons unknown and mob violence, I think, will continue. So if you have to go out, be very alert. Be aware of your surroundings. If there are whites who are being loud, hostile, still not a good time to be engaging in any sort of verbal arguments with strangers. You should be thinking, this person could be armed. This person might have a whole mob with them that's armed. I'm going to get out of here. If you need to call enforcement officers or whatever, do that as you are exiting. If you did not leave your residence prepared for mortal combat, we are avoiding all risk averse still, avoiding all signs of a skirmish with some random person over a parking space or roll of toilet tissue or whatever it is. Again, if you're going out, hopefully it's something serious. You can be alert about things. If you are driving or passenger, you are buckled. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. Again, we want to be very aware of what's happening. And then two, we're trying to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Doing the small things, not being on the cell phone, sober, buckled up, just little things that we can control in a system of total terrorism. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect in all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling. Super. Jeff Toobin had to lie on Johnny Cochran and say he called Christopher Darden a nigger. That right there. The importance of name calling. They love that. They know that that keeps the system moving along. Have some black self-respect. I'm not going to participate in name calling other victims of racism. 10 stops. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.